he was readily available when we were in the trees. Reach over and have a lemon.
Yeah.
I mean, that's oversimplifying, but there's some truth in that. And what they do is they prey upon it. And then, you know, then there's the discussion about things like high fructose corn syrup. I'm so serious about that stuff that I've actually sat down and talked to my kids, not sat down, but I've actually shown my kids labels in the grocery store. I'm trying to turn them into label readers.
Good.
And I said, you know, this, whenever you see these words, high fructose corn syrup, know that you are dealing with garbage that is bad for your body. It'll roast your Isles of Langerhans. It'll screw up your insulin production. Because more and more evidence is pointing toward this stuff as almost a sole cause of the rapid increase in the diabetic population in this country.
Yep, that's right. And that's great that you're talking to your kids about that stuff. I mean,
yeah, they think I'm a geek, Preston.
Yeah, but still.
But that's my job. I'm dad. I've got to work the geek factor.
Yeah, and it's activism. You know, it's the most important kind of activism.
And that's kind of what chapped me when I had that story last night about Walmart and the country of origin labeling. Can you imagine that as American citizens, we don't even have the right to know where the turkey came from we're going to put on the table tomorrow? We're just left to assume that it came from some happy little industrial turkey Auschwitz somewhere in mid-America?
Right. I mean, free markets. They're always talking about free markets, but if there were such a thing, it would involve that sort of information.
Well, Preston, if I can't make an informed decision about the stuff I'm buying, I'm not participating in a free market because I am not a free purchaser.
Exactly. Exactly. We're not being given the information to make our choices, informed choices. It's a real shame. Actually, I was just listening to a story on Democracy Now! About these crucifixes that were being made in some horrendous sweatshop.
Oh, I've got the story in my stack right now. And it was one of those things. Sometimes I run across stories, Preston, that I think, oh, man, this has got to make it to the show. But then, you know, I read further, and I usually give things, you know, two or three or four reads just to sort of let them get down into the cellular level in my soul.
Yeah.
And I've read it like six times, and I get a little bit madder every time, to the point that I'm afraid that if I bring the story up, I'm just going to wind up sputtering at the microphone. Yes, crucifixes, you know, with the bloody Jesus hanging on it, you know. Granted, he gets a loincloth because we can't imagine a naked Savior, even though everybody was crucified naked. The Romans weren't nearly so squeamish as we are. Thousands upon thousands upon thousands of these things manufactured in sweatshops in China where people work 15 hours a day making Jesus for pennies on the hour.
Yep. And not only were they not sharing place of origin information, they were deceiving people about it. They'd put made in Italy on some of them anyway. And the Charles Kernighan, this incredible sweatshop, anti-sweatshop crusader, talked about how they're selling them like the crazy Eddie of crucifixes. You know, we will not be undersold. All these crosses must go. And
I must be crazy for selling crucifixes this cheap.
Exactly. But anyway, thankfully they were busted by Charles Kernighan, and you know, they're scrambling.
And I don't want to take anything away from what Mr. Carnegie has done, and I'm not. But am I overly pessimistic, Preston, when I suspect that for every one of these that get busted, there's a dozen out there that aren't?
It's a huge problem, for sure. Were these being made in, was it Vietnam or was it China?
China. You know? The story I've got says China.
Okay. Well, yeah. Yeah, and I'm sure there are more in Vietnam and in Haiti and... Yeah.
And what I hate is the fact that I know that there's a fundamentalist out there somewhere, Preston, who is saying, well, maybe they're gonna come to understand the saving grace of Jesus Christ by working in that sweatshop.
They'll say that. They'll also say, well, at least we're giving them jobs. They had nothing before. You know, I mean, we're so ignorant of other cultures and...
Well, we don't bother to ask things like, I mean, we just assume that, you know, oh, look, they got a couple of billion people in China. And, you know, we make assumptions. And they're really, really bigoted assumptions, Preston. Things like, well, you know, they were just sitting around till we brought the industry over. No, they weren't. They were, in fact, peasant farmers, what we'd call in the Deep South dirt farmers, subsistence farmers.
Mm-hmm.
And they lived in places, because, again, it's something we don't talk about, they lived in places along the route of something called the Three Gorges Dam. Massive, massive, ancient geographic areas that supported tremendous populations for centuries upon centuries, and subsistence farming. And frankly, there's no sin in subsistence farming. The only sin in subsistence farming is found by the globalists who see a subsistence farmer as a waste of slave labor.
That's right. And somebody who's independent of, you know, what they're selling. You know, they don't want people to be able to grow their own food and maybe develop their own little markets, their own little local markets, and grow stuff without their pesticides and their grow meat without antibiotics and steroids. By the same token,
I don't get too terribly romantic about it. All of that is true. I also recognize, however, because it comes from my own history to a certain extent. I've mentioned it a couple of times. When the three Kincaid brothers came over from Scotland, they were the sons of a very prominent, very well-respected publisher. I mean, you can look up all kinds of famous titles in English literature, and you'll find that it was published by Alexander Kincaid the first time through. Well, it was his three sons who had to flee to the United States, or the colonies, actually, to get away from the crown because they backed the wrong horse in the revolution. And within three generations, those three sons of a publisher, within three generations, their progeny was illiterate. Because all they had time for was subsistence farming.
Yeah. Well, interesting. And, you know, subsistence farming, being a peasant, a campesino, an indigenous person, you know, maybe it's not our thing. Maybe it's something that we wouldn't favor for ourselves or how we've been acculturated or grew up, whatever. And not to romanticize people of other cultures. You know, they've got their own issues and so on and so forth. But, you know, viva la difference, you know, and for us to impose our system. You know, it's classic colonial thinking. You know, we're going to liberate them by introducing them to our fantastic ways of progress. And, you know, the Vietnam War very much was about restructuring that society. I mean, people often say that we lost that war, and in some ways...
Go look at the children chained to the sweatshops and tell me we lost. We got exactly what we wanted.
Cheap labor, having access to the resources... destroying what would have been a model of a different way of being in the world. And the cultural devastation, I mean, in places like Laos, they bombed this area, the U.S. Air Force, the Plain of Jars, it's called.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this huge area, and there are these old giant jars that people aren't sure what they are used for, maybe storing food, maybe liquor. People don't know, but archaeologists to this day can't go and study these things because there's so much unexploded ordnance around them.
It's not the Plain of Jars anymore. It's the Plain of Bomblets.
That's right. And Cambodians have to teach their children, they're like, be careful, these shiny metal objects. And it's so sad. They even teach them these songs, like these nursery rhymes about... don't pick up the metal object. Every month, people are dying there. Farmers run into these unexploded bombs.
But we can't be bothered with that, Preston, because we're in the middle of a global economic miracle.
Right. A miracle for the bomb makers and for Monsanto. You know, 18 million gallons of Agent Orange we dumped on Vietnam alone. 18 million gallons. It's interesting. Recently, there wasn't a word about it in our liberal media, but just in the past couple of years, some Vietnamese had taken the case to court to try to get some compensation like our veterans had to do for so many years. And the Vietnamese were doing it themselves. It was thrown out recently. I forget the excuse, but they're appealing it. So it'll be interesting to see where that goes. And now Monsanto is developing, you know, new markets in Colombia to fight the so-called war on drugs.
Look what happened with Chiquita Bananas, Preston. We're kind of up against the top of the hour, but we need to take a couple of minutes for this because we haven't really touched on it on this program or any other on the horn that I'm aware of.
Okay.
Look at what happened with Chiquita Bananas. They just went into federal criminal court, Chiquita Bananas, and pled guilty to hiring terrorists.
Yep.
To slaughter, intimidate, torture, murder people who cut bananas out of trees and pack them into boxes. The Bush administration didn't send anybody to jail. They didn't punish any of the corporate hierarchy who made conscious, intentional, willful, with malice aforethought decisions to hire terrorists. They just fined them $250,000 and said, you know, don't do it again, okay?
Right.
And Chiquita said, okay, we won't. And of course they will.
Yeah.
And this story gets repeated time after time after time. It's coal miners in Colombia. It's banana plantation workers in Honduras and Guatemala. You know, I'm making can I take a topic and run somewhere completely else with it? I'm sitting here I'm talking about the Chiquita story. Every Thanksgiving, I make banana pudding. It's one of the desserts that we have at Thanksgiving because we all love it. And I've got my own little particular variation on it. And I stood at the grocery store early today, and, okay, Chiquita, I don't want Chiquita. Dole. Oh, yeah, there's some good people. And right. I went over to the organic section. No organic bananas today, thanks. But if there had been organic bananas, they were going to be $2.75 a pound.
Yeah.
The dice are loaded. The wheel is rigged. And if I want to do something as simple, and you know, this is the family holiday, this is our blessed feast, this is something we Americans do that nobody else does. Nobody else has a Thanksgiving feast. Yeah, right. But it's supposed to be, you know, we gather together to eat the dry turkey and over the river and through the woods to grandmother's house we go, and we throw the weakest member to the wolves that are chasing the sled.
Yeah, other countries have their Thanksgiving weeks, you know, celebrations.
Yeah, we get a day.
Right.
Yeah, and don't think you're getting off work Friday, Buster. You be back here, you get the pink slip.
I'm going to work Friday.
Yeah, and I can't even make a stinking banana pudding that isn't just larded up with the corporate greed, bloodshed, and guilt. And I got to keep this one to myself. You know, it's not the, I'll tell the kids after Thanksgiving.
Right. It's hard to balance all that stuff.
Yeah,
sure.
And the boy, Ferg, looks at me and goes, will you put the pineapple and the coconut in it, too? And I'm sitting there inside my own tiny little tormented skull, Preston, going, yeah, I can put the blood, sweat, and tears of another oppressed class in the banana pudding, too, boy. You betcha.
Right.
Ugh.
I wanted to mention that I saw that film that David was talking about. This film is not yet rated.
Mm-hmm.
I received it a couple, probably 4 or 5 months ago. It was the monthly selection from the Iron Weed Film Club. It's kind of a progressive, they distribute kind of progressive independent films that are kind of easy to miss. And I found that interesting. And also, Michelle mentioned a documentary on PETA. PETA and it. Co-founder Ingrid Newkirk.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting. It was on HBO, and I'm not a vegetarian myself, but I, you know, I think I respect that choice for sure.
I feel like I'm being herded toward it.
I've cut back on my meat consumption drastically, for sure, and the meat industry, they can't stand that. I mean, that's a, you know, they're losing a 3% in their revenue or whatever, and so they really go after PETA big time. But
well, who was it? Was it Oprah a few years back? I mean, Oprah, multi-billionaire Oprah, that was driven to her knees and forced to apologize by the American Beef Producers Association? Oprah.
Right. She had Howard Lyman, a former rancher himself, and big meat eater who became a vegetarian and saw all the chemicals. And in fact, he tells the story of changing his father's ranch from like a family-run traditional style farm to this, you know, he said, I went to school and I learned how to make it more efficient. and make it more moderate and started to pour chemicals in it and turned it into this huge and hugely successful money-wise multi-head mega feedlot. And he was in thinking holistically at the time, and that he had some experiences with his own health, and he started to look into what was going on here. And now he's a vegetarian, and he's been talking about mad cow disease and all that stuff. And yeah, it was on Oprah that they were talking about that, and Oprah made the mistake of saying, "I'm not going to eat another hamburger." And that's, yeah, she said that, and they said she caused a drop in our stocks or whatever. And yeah, took her to court, and amazing, amazing case. But Howard Lyman keeps pressing on. He just published another book called, I think, No Bull or something like that. And, you know, we have a lot of people out there who are, although we don't see it on Fox or CNN or so many other major outlets at the grassroots, there are all these figures like Howard Lyman and groups like the Ironweed Film Club that are creating a different sort of media.
Well, I'm going to go and look up the Ironweed Film Club, Preston. That sounds intriguing. That would be a couple of hours a week or a month, you know, well worth spending.
Yeah. Me and Peter Gottbold, we're both fans of Netflix. And, you know, it can be very expensive to go out to the films. And I found that very useful to be a member of that. It's like $16 a month or so, and you can get a bunch of movies in that time. And I have found, even though it's a big corporation and everything, I found some documentaries there that I just wasn't finding anyplace else. And they also are putting part of their funds into the production of some very good, challenging films. They open their own kind of production wing called, I think, Red Stripe Films or something like that. And they're putting out some very good material, so there are some things to be thankful for.
Indeed. Preston, yeah. you bring so many great ideas and so many great issues to the table. I really appreciate you calling in. If I'm going to keep on the schedule that I've established for this evening, I'm going to have to run away and do the news now. But thank you so much, and you know, sorry you have to go to work on Friday. You'd think that, you know, the American economic juggernaut could spare a stinking Friday, but I guess not.
No, not this time, but but I've got tomorrow off, and I'm going to be enjoying that. So enjoy your Thanksgiving.
Indeed,
well.
and to everyone you love and everyone you care about, please pass our warmest regards.
Great, I'll do that.
Take care, Preston.
Bye-bye.
I turned down the wrong thing. There we go. I just love the stuff that Preston brings. We'll take a little break for some news. We'll come back, and there's still some stuff on the table to get to. And I expect we'll be talking with our good friend, the Internet's most brilliant satirist, Eugene Finnerman, when we come back. You're listening to America's Liberal Voice. You're listening to The Horn. What do you think of that? Thanks, Billy.
This is the Quality News Network. A pre-holiday plunge on the Dow. We'll have the numbers coming up in our business segment. Meantime, airports and train stations across the U.S. packed with travelers today. A record 39 million Americans expected to travel at least 50 miles this Thanksgiving holiday. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice says while she is looking forward to next week's Middle Eastern Peace Conference in Annapolis, Maryland, she is cautious about expecting too much from a fragile diplomacy. World powers will gather to promote a peace deal between the Israelis and Palestinians in order to gain some stability in the war-torn Middle East. Thousands of displaced Iraqis have begun returning to their homes. That's according to the BBC. An estimated 1,000 Iraqis make it back home daily because of a drop in violence, improved security, and incentives from the Iraqi government. Pakistani President General Pervez Musharraf may leave his military post as soon as this weekend, according to a top government official. He'll then take the presidential oath as a civilian, satisfying a key directive by Western powers, including the White House. In Bangladesh, shelters and rescue camps overrun with victims of the country's worst storm in a decade. Food and water are now running out, more bodies being discovered, thousands still remaining missing. Ending months of speculation, officials with the state of New Hampshire announced that their presidential primary will be held on January 8th. Iowa's caucuses have led the way for several decades, but New Hampshire has had the initial primary for even longer, since 1920. The announcement comes on the heels of Michigan State's decision to hold their primary on January 15th. The French government and striking transit workers went back to the bargaining table today. President Nicolas Sarkozy warning saboteurs of the country's high-speed rail lines that they would be punished with, quote, extreme severity. The strike has crippled France and is costing the economy an estimated $500 million per day. In Japan, thousands of civilian workers on U.S. military bases are striking today to protest a 10% pay cut. Their paychecks are paid by Tokyo, which has long attempted to cut costs for that particular program. And according to the Calorie Control Council, on Thanksgiving Day, the average American eats 4,500 calories and nearly 230 grams of fat. You're listening to the Quality News Network. Science and Business News is next.
Looking to find the best in the USA? Come to Boulevards.com. We're the best address and city guides across the U.S. For the best information in travel, Boulevards.com gives you the most up-to-date choices for the best in dining, hotels, entertainment, adventure, and exciting tips to make your holiday the best it can be. Whether you're a local or just looking for great getaway tips, go to Boulevards.com and get the best. Be independent of search engines. Make your choices. We're Boulevards.com. Come visit us at SanFrancisco.com, SanJose.com, Carmel.com, WashingtonDC.com, PaloAlto.com, Seattle.com, Oakland.com, SanAntonio.com, Denver.com, and many more. We are Boulevards.com, the best in your visiting the USA. Come visit us at Boulevards.com.
British scientists have discovered a 390-million-year-old fossilized claw that indicates prehistoric bugs were far larger than previously envisioned. The ancient sea scorpion is thought to have been at least 8 feet long. The Centers for Disease Control report that American adults are exercising more. However, there is still room for more improvement, according to that study. Freddie Mac announcing a massive quarterly net loss of $2.3 billion. The government-sponsored mortgage company says it was forced to set aside $1.2 billion to pay for home loans gone sour. Construction of single-family homes fell last month to a 16-year low. However, the Commerce Department reporting a significant boost in construction of apartments. Shares of Office Depot falling 6% after it announced its quarterly profit fell by 9%. The world's largest office supply company cited reduced consumer spending and the housing slump for that decline. Retailer Limited Brands blamed unseasonably warm autumn weather for poor sales and a 48% plunge in quarterly profit. The Ohio-based company lowered its financial outlook. Light sweet crude trading at $97.29 a barrel. At today's close of Wall Street, the Dow Jones plunging 211 points to end at 12,799. NASDAQ down 34 points. The S&P 500 down 23. More at our website, QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Barbara Lewis.
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins next. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Buck.
All right. And as promised, our good friend Eugene Finnerman of FinnermanWorks.com, FinnermanWorks.com, the Internet's most brilliant satirist, is, in fact, awaiting on the line, and I'll bring him on in just a moment. I want to take care of a couple of, just a little bit of business first, if you don't mind. I got an email in. You know, I get emails. saying, I would teach my son, and I did. I raised a radical lefty. I would tell him why we don't eat bananas anymore, talking about me and the conversation with my boy. And why not just tell him why you adjusted the menu? I tell my kids a lot. I'll never forget the day that my daughters wept as I explained to them why I wouldn't buy them any Mary-Kate and Ashley products. And I explained to them what happens to the little kids chained to the tables. And I got in big trouble with Agnes. I think the phrase was, "Let them be children, Bob." And so, you know, that informs a little bit of it. And there will be time, and there will be time, and they will be informed. But I can't take it away all at once. And frankly, I can't raise bananas here. I can't raise oranges, lemons, limes. I can't raise kiwi fruit. And to some degree or another, because of the nature of the world in which we live, there is a level of blood and cruelty. I can buy dolphin-safe tuna, but I can't buy a cruelty-free banana. I respect PETA. I'm glad they did the expose here in West Virginia that showed the non-union, underpaid, overworked staffers getting their taking out the frustration they would ordinarily reserve for a boss by, slamming chickens into walls. Glad they did that. Kind of put me off the colonel, if you know what I mean, because those chickens were going to Kentucky Fried. Or, I'm sorry, it's just KFC now, because I don't think in at least Great Britain they're not allowed to refer to what they sell as actually being chicken. So, yeah, I do tell them. But I try not to, you know, I try not to tell them before dinner. And we're going to just... they know enough already as it is, and I'll continue to give it to them, but I'll give it to them judiciously. Because otherwise you can just send people run screaming away, and they won't want to read labels anymore, and they won't want to pay attention to this stuff. You can overload. So, you know, there's that. And coming up toward the end of the program, like I said, we'll also have Alice's Restaurant as a traditional thing. Another thing, the telling of the Kincaid family great shopping escapade of years past. But right now, as I said, the Internet's most brilliant satirist joins us, Eugene Finnerman. Eugene, thanks for taking time to talk a little turkey.
I'm delighted to be here. I want to give thanks to having a disciple like you. I just need 11 more.
and we start a new religion, right?
I'll settle for a cult.
Okay, well,
competing with Hare Krishnas, we'll be better dressed.
Better dressed, but hopefully equally well funded.
Now that'd be the Unification Church. I'm not. Is such a thing as a left wing version of a Unification Church? Well, anyway.
No, because being lefties, we can't agree. We can't agree on what we're going to have for lunch, let alone a doctrine or a dogma. But you have taken considerable pains to lay out some of the history of Thanksgiving, and instead of passing along the usual, they wanted to live in peace and stuff. No, that really didn't obtain in history, did it, Eugene? This wasn't about living in peace with the illegal pale immigrants, was it?
Well, look at it from two perspectives. The first is that, molded by grade school lessons and Hallmark commercials, we reverently refer to those brave pioneers at Plymouth as our Pilgrim Fathers. Of course, if we actually did file a class action paternity suit, most of us couldn't prove it. Furthermore, we really wouldn't want to be related to them.
I wouldn't want to live next door to them.
Ironically, you're the one far more likely to be related than I am.
There's that.
But the fact you're absolutely right. The Pilgrims were a bunch of 17th century Jerry Falwells. And they were the loony fringe of the Puritans. You know, compared to them, Oliver Cromwell was a liberal softy.
Well, okay, let's try to... Eugene, let's stop right there and see if we can't put that in modern terms. There are Baptists. Jerry Falwell, for instance. And they're nuts. These guys were the Fred Phelps crowd. And really, Fred Phelps would be right at home. And you know who I'm talking about, right?
I believe so, yes.
This is the guy, the preacher that goes around to soldiers' funerals saying that the soldier died because God hates fags. And you know, I mean, that's the sign that he holds up. I'm not trying to offend anybody.
You can get AIDS from listening to Tchaikovsky. Exactly.
Right. And so, you know, even the loonies disavow him. But that kind of hatred would be absolutely not only welcome, but joyously celebrated among the so-called Pilgrim Fathers, wouldn't it?
I mean, you know, well, I mean, we were taught that these pilgrims fled religious persecution in England and Holland. In fact, they fled religious tolerance in those countries. Think of that. They fled religious tolerance. I mean, pilgrims could not abide other Protestants except the equally more, you know, morbid Presbyterians. You can only imagine how they regarded Catholics.
Yeah, the morbid Presbyterians, those are my relatives, Eugene.
The Scotsman, yeah.
Yeah.
But the pilgrims wanted nothing less than a theocracy where only they had the freedom of worship. In England, however, the Anglicans seemed unwilling to persecute themselves. I mean, who can understand that? And Holland was even more depraved. It tolerated Catholics and, gasp, Jews.
Not the Jews.
Yeah, isn't that, you know, talk about sectual depravity.
Ba-dum-bum.
And that was the pilgrims' idea of hell. Not my puns, but just, you know, religious tolerance.
Although we could put them on the list.
Probably. Well, it's a form of torture anyway. And the pilgrims were everyone else's idea of obnoxious. If the Calvinist bigots wanted a theocracy, England did have a practical solution. In the most generous way of saying good riddance, the crown offered the pilgrims their own colony in North America, thousands of quiet miles from England. The fanatics would be free to bore and bully. And if they survived, then...
And
God,
that's a big if, the if they survived part. That's a big if.
That is.
And the crown was probably counting on that not necessarily coming to fruition.
You know, they couldn't really lose. If they survived, then God and England had a new colony. And if they didn't survive, well, we still shouldn't think that the crown was actually rooting for the Indians.
Even if they were.
Be indiscreet.
Yeah. So,
I mean, these were the, you know, I call them the Grim Pill Fathers.
You know, not the most color coordinated bunch, unless,
oh,
you know.
Oh, no, I disagree. They actually were.
Well, monochromatic sort of way. In a monochromatic sort of way.
Yes. Black, navy, blue, anything that actually hinted of, you know, color, vibrancy, was suspiciously Catholic. Which is why they had a war on Christmas, by the way. That seemed just too festive to be, you know, suitably... You know,
that's true, and, you know...
Acceptably Protestant.
I know our good friend Peter Godbold from Strictly Confidential is actually keeping up with the number of days remaining in the war on Christmas. We've only... We've only got a few weeks left in which to crucify a Santa Claus or burn a Christmas tree upside down or some such. I'll watch the chat and see if maybe Peter can tell me how many days yet remain in the war on Christmas. But you're absolutely right. Apart from what I pointed out last night, to wit, that all the business about you can't find Christ on a Christmas card anymore started out in 1920 with Henry Ford and some of the most filthy anti-Semitic screeds ever printed in America. The original war on Christmas was waged by so-called Christian fundamentalists, right?
Precisely, the Calvinists. When Cromwell was ruling England, Christmas, you know, the practice of Christmas was, you know, the celebration of Christmas was prohibited. I mean, even... John Milton thought that was a little extreme.
And when John Milton thought something was extreme...
Yes, he was not exactly, you know, a party animal himself.
No, wasn't on the A-list.
No.
So, did they eliminate Christmas, or did they just make it into this doer time of sitting down and doing extra Bible reading, or what?
The holiday itself, the birth of Christ, was observed in solemn prayer. You know, anything that would, you know, hint of festivity, however, was ungodly.
I saw you smirk. You're going to burn
tomorrow. No, that was a Catholic trait. No, hanging.
Hanging, yeah. Pressing, yes. Pressing's good.
Yes, I mean, for some reason, burning was a Catholic, you know, the auto defes were a Catholic monopoly. You could burn in hell, but not on earth.
Right, and it was raised to either high or low art under the Inquisition. But coming back to Thanksgiving,
of course,
Eugene. You know, we're taught that the first Thanksgiving, you know, the Indians show up with all this yummy food.
Mm-hmm. I have my suspicion.
Yeah, you ever seen the menu?
I practically, you know, could have written it, because it's just the foods that I hate and that any person with functioning taste buds would dislike. That was the Indians' plan. You know, as chief of the neighborhood, it was Massasoit's responsibility to get rid of the Europeans. They just couldn't be ignored. The Hurons to the north in Canada had tried coexisting with their intruders, those who seemed to call themselves the Mon Dieu. But the poor Hurons ended up being enslaved to strange rituals, serving red wine with muskrat but white wine with pelican.
Jesus.
If these Europeans were so meticulous about food, Massasoit would use their obsessive quirks against them. He would convince these aliens that the local food was disgusting, so they might as well leave.
Nothing to eat here. Move along.
He plotted the most inedible menu and then brought over the abominations as gifts. The main course was what the tribe called mutant chicken. None of the locals would eat anything that ugly. For a side dish, there were bog berries. You know, those tongue-shriveling fruits, they were said to be healthy, but most people would prefer scurvy. The most laughable squash and roots were passed off as delicacies rather than weeds. Finally, and most cruel of all, the Europeans were served maize. We know it as corn. That alone should have sent the Europeans fleeing home for dental floss. But to Massasoit's amazement, these Europeans were impervious to this awful parody of a meal. He had failed to realize that these were different Europeans. Yes, the Mon Dieu would have been horrified, but these aliens were called English, and they had no taste buds or teeth. But they were here to stay.
Oh, my God. And you know, we think about it, in all seriousness, Eugene, we think about the vast majority of the world diet now comes from the New World, and you know, as obnoxious as it may have
Christ, you're absolutely right.
And wheat, you know, and barley and stuff, but no, corn, you know, corn fuels the world now too.
Corn, potatoes,
tomatoes, chili peppers, sweet bell peppers, on and on and on. So as a consequence, the one thing that Massasoit probably didn't take into consideration was that these people had been subsisting for about 15,000 years on turnips and onions and garlic and the occasional sheep. So what he brought over probably looked pretty darn good.
Oh, they would have had, in England, the diet, you know, everything would have been boiled. That was the height of English cuisine, but either that or burned. Let's see.
There is,
basically, deer, anything they could catch that wasn't, you know, that they could get away with poaching. But primarily, remember, bread was literally the staff of life.
Yeah, yeah.
Everything else was the side dish.
Everything else was what you dipped the bread in. Uh-huh. And, you know, from your forebears to mine. The meal was what you managed to do with bread. So when they showed up over here, and of course, you know, the first Thanksgiving comes around. By the next Thanksgiving, there's no feast because, you know, the Indians, Native Americans, the Hurons, part of the, is this too early for the Iroquois Confederacy?
Possibly not too early, but the wrong location.
Yeah, yeah, true.
That would have been closer to New York. Here you're talking about the Narragansett. If you're talking New England, you're talking about the Narragansett, the Pequot.
The Quahog.
The Sacamores, I think, is another name.
Yeah, yeah.
Massasoit's particular group was something called the Wampog.
Right, right.
Shouldn't you hum the Jeopardy theme while I'm doing this?
Does it help?
The Hurons were in the north, and, you know, they'd be, you know, Canadian.
True. So what you have, and you know, all the fraud that gets passed off. I had a darn good time absorbing last year, and my books have a way of disappearing. I got to find it again because it's time for a reread. I've referenced on this show a couple of times a book by Charles C. Mann called 1491, and he goes into exhaustive detail of what the lifestyle was of Massasoit's people and the people that surrounded them. And yeah, they squabbled amongst themselves, but you know what, Eugene, they lived in paradise. They really did, honest to God, live in paradise. If something didn't eat you, there was very little disease going around. They lived to more advanced age than the white people who came there. And quite interestingly, one of the frauds that gets passed off on school children is Squanto. Are you familiar with this?
Well, of course. I even endured the movie.
In other words, no.
It's true. Walt Disney wouldn't lie to me.
No, never. That mouse means well. No, Squanto had actually been kidnapped and made it all the way to Spain, hadn't he?
Yes.
And worked his way back to England and back across the Atlantic, only to find out that the tribe from which he... if you're a kid and you're bookish, sooner or later you will wander across James Fenimore Cooper's The Last of the Mohicans.
Mm-hmm.
And long before there was ever a Last of the Mohicans, there was a Last of the Pequods or the Wampawags, because Squanto was it. Squanto wasn't even his name. I wish I had the book at hand. But by the time he makes it back to England, his entire tribe is dead, because
smallpox is very effective.
It is indeed. And you know, it leads you, I don't want to go too far afield. Man, where does the time go, Eugene? But weapons of mass destruction? Saddam had nothing on George Bush's and my direct forebears. We wiped out what?
90% of the within about from the period of Columbus to within a century, about 90% of the.
And that's a population that is now
wiped out.
Yeah, that's a population that is now estimated somewhere on the order of having been around 26 to 35 million people.
Well, I think it was more than that.
You're right.
I think it was closer to. I think they talk about the population of Latin America being about 100 million, and within a century it was down to about 10. And most of it, although the conquistadors were none too gentle, even they couldn't kill that many. It was the smallpox.
It was the measles.
I mean, we swapped germs. They gave us syphilis, and we gave them smallpox. We obviously got the better deal of the two.
Yeah, even if it turns out that...
I mean, no one has fun catching smallpox.
Well, there is that. Well, Eugene, what is on the plate at the Finnerman home for Thanksgiving tomorrow?
I imagine it's going to be the usual fare. I'll be with my wife and her family.
Oh dear, I didn't know.
And since she's probably within ear range, I can't really give you details about the family, but I can tell you it'll be a traditional fare. We'll be serving turkey, cranberry, stuffing, none of the things I really like, you know. Help me God, if I'd been at Plymouth in 1621, I dare say the only Jew there, I would have tried ordering out for Mexican.
Not Chinese? I thought you guys were notorious for your passion for Chinese.
It's true, we do. But, you know, I mean, Moses spent 40 years in the desert trying to find a decent Szechuan. But the fact is that, I mean, we're also reasonably practical. Well, as practical as being Jewish can be. And you just, you know, I mean, obviously Mexican food was closer than Chinese.
Well, and you still would have been out of luck even with the traditional table there, Eugene, because the other stuff that was on there were oysters, shrimp, and lobsters.
Well, actually, I like shrimp. So, you know, I'm a Reformed Jew. So, and my dietary habits, they are closer to Leon Trotsky's. Yeah. But,
I didn't know there was a Trotskyite Reformation.
Well, actually, well, you know, someone some ridiculous woman once asked, who's not a relative, once asked me where I went to the synagogue, and I said, B'nai Trotsky.
Well, you know, here in Charleston...
Well, because I was trying to offend her, by the way.
Yeah, here in Charleston, we have something similar. It's B'nai Hillbilly. You know, and I think it was the basketball coach for the University of Tennessee, a gentleman by the name of Bruce Pearl, who said, I have come to Tennessee, and I am living in the middle of the Jew's dilemma. I'm in the land of free bacon.
Well, remember, the Confederacy had a Jewish Secretary of State a century ahead of the rest of the United States.
That is true. Benjamin...
Judah Benjamin.
Yeah, Judah Benjamin. I knew there was a Benjamin in there somewhere.
Yes, indeed. Which explains why I'm so confused by, you know, rap music when they say looking for the Benjamins. I always assumed there was allusion to a Jewish family.
Yeah, just down the street.
Yes.
Eugene, I wish you a very, very happy Thanksgiving. I always love our conversations. Don't be such a doggone stranger, will you?
Well, I want to thank you and also your listeners for only burning me an effigy. And, you know, wish you all a happy holiday.
Well, thank you very much. And,
I'll be eating ice cream as soon as I get home from Thanksgiving, so I'll have something digestible.
I'd load up at breakfast or something before you go over the river and through the woods and all of that stuff.
Just don't like turkey, and I'm normally a glutton, so.
Yeah, I know.
I've heard of all the wonderful things you're doing with the turkey, and.
Well, you know, and I got an email. You'll be interested to know. One of your readers, as a matter of fact, shot me an email right after I mentioned the fact that I was going to try to thaw the turkey by hickory smoking it.
Hmm?
Subject line: Got peanut butter? You try that turkey smoking approach, and you just might need a whole bunch of peanut butter and some serious jelly inventory. Because, you know, the implication being ain't going to be edible. I'm blessed here because you know, you talk about giving thanks, Eugene. I'm so fortunate here. I've got the audience that spends its time and shares its time with the Horn are people who get a rise out of the kind of stuff that you write, who pay serious attention to the world around them, and aren't afraid to learn about and laugh at the foibles of our human existence from time to time. And you know what? That makes my job just downright easy.
And for me, it's very therapeutic, too.
This is my 3 hours on a couch every night. And speaking of 3 hours on a couch... I understand. You'll probably need it when you get home tomorrow. So, you know what? I'll be thinking about you. And please give our best to your lovely wife and note that I didn't say anything untoward.
You never do. She worries about.
Yeah, I can get away with it.
You shouldn't encourage me.
I'm out of reach. Yeah, I
okay,
right.
You take care. Happy holiday to you.
And to you too, Eugene. Take care.
Bye-bye. Bye.
The Internet's sharpest satirist. If you are not signed up for your RDA of irony, why aren't you? If Eugene charged you, would you be more likely to? No, just sign up. You get these little gems every day. Today, Eugene did an extended explanation of King Charles of Sweden, who I think got his rear end handed to him on this day in 1711 or 04 or something. And wow, you're not going to get it anywhere else on the web. I'm sorry, you're just not. And that's one of the things that makes the Internet so doggone brilliant and makes having Eugene on the Internet even more so. Eugene is probably good for a 20-point rise in the general IQ of the Internet. Let's put it that way. So we are... fast approaching the end of tonight's program, two things remain on the agenda. I'll take care of the one first. And that is to tell you that once upon a time, when our babies were little, I think our eldest would have been maybe 11, which would have made
or 12, okay, which would have made the next one down 6, followed by 4, followed by 3. Yeah, somewhere around in there. Maybe 13, 7, 5, and 4. Yeah, that's probably more like it. Yeah, about 7 years ago. 6, maybe. So, 14, 8, 6, and 5. That's perfect. That's it. Yeah. Yeah. 14, 6, 8, and 5. And I had managed to convince Agnes. It was this night, okay? And it was before I went back into radio. And I had gotten home from my daily job of screwing some of the most hurting people in this state for a living. And I enjoy cooking the holiday meal. And I said to Agnes, you know, load up the babies. Let's go across the river and grocery shop together. God knows we don't get to go out on dates or anything like that. The least we can do is enjoy this time together, and then we'll go grocery shopping as a family. She protested. Driving over, she looked at me and she said, "This is not a good idea." "Oh, come on, lighten up. It's the night before Thanksgiving. We'll have fun." I should learn to trust Agnes's instincts. So we went into, it was Kroger's. We went into Kroger. And of course, there were 4 of them and 2 of us. We were from the outset outnumbered. And we started our orderly, you know, I've got a grocery shopping list about as long as my arm, because it wasn't like, you know, we got most of the stuff. And no, I was going to do it all in one evening. And we started our orderly progress through the produce, you know, going the way that the grocery store sort of drives you. You start out in the produce and you make your loop around, up and down the aisles. And my boy is rambunctious, if he is anything. And for a long time, not so much now, but still a little bit, for a long time, people assumed that our 2 youngest were twins. And where one went, the other followed. Now, the 2 eldest stayed right, because we, you know, just burned it into their brains. Stay with the group. And they did. On the other hand, Ferg and Doodle, well, they had their own agenda. And they knew that they were going to work it. So they began doing wind sprints up and down the aisle. Agnes left the buggy. Agnes chased them down, brought them, you know, herded them back to the group. And we continued down another aisle and up another one. They took off again. You got to understand, a grocery store aisle is nothing if it is not a temptation to just go at a dead run for little kids. Just like, you know, you were always taught in grade school, you know, you can't run in the hall. Why not? It's the perfect place to run. And so they did. And I think it was 3 times or so that Agnes gave up. She got what we refer to in this family as Klingon head. Because that means her brow has furrowed so much that she actually gets that sort of turtle-shaped thing going in the center of her forehead that makes her look a lot like a Klingon warrior queen. And she was disgusted. And it was cold outside, and she had on her long overcoat. Beautiful. Because she is. And she said, "Listen, I'm taking these 2. We're going to go and sit in the car. You take the 2 good children and shop with them and teach them how to shop and do the Thanksgiving thing and have fun. We're going to the car."
Oh, honey, don't do that. Don't be a spoil sport. Come on. I mean, they're just kids. It's a no. They're going to break something. We'll wind up having to pay for it, and I'm not going to have myself embarrassed, and I'm not going to have you embarrassed. We're going, and you know, trust your judgment. Okay. So Agnes and I part company. She taking Ferg and Doodle, and me left with the two eldest. And we proceed to shop. Oh, we linger over this turkey and that turkey. We stop in the spice aisle to make sure that we've got sage. There's no sense in even trying to do Thanksgiving dinner without sage for the dressing. A couple of big packages of cornmeal for plenty of cornbread to go in the dressing. You know, you got to have celery. You got to have this. You got to have that. Big bag of potatoes. Tons of butter. Pie shells. Pumpkin. I think I did a cheesecake that year, so there was cream cheese to be gotten. And all the while, I was utterly, in typical husbandly fashion, clueless of what was transpiring elsewhere in the store. Because Ferg and Doodle did not want to leave. They were having the time of their lives sprinting up and down the aisles. And they were wailing, and they were screaming, and they were crying. They were doing all the things that when other people's children are doing it in a grocery store or a department store, you look and you go, what kind of parent are you? Well, you know, when you are a parent, you find out that, you know, you really don't have any control over this. This is them working you. This is them testing their boundaries. This is them seeing what they can get away with. And they weren't going to get away with it with Agnes. One child in one, by one hand, the other child by the other, and walking toward the front of the store, at which point my children, who are related to me and to Agnes, and therefore are quick of wit and quicker of mouth, once they saw other human beings at the front of the store, each following the other's lead, or in some sort of circular logic, flopped onto the ground and screamed, let go of us. Let go of us. You're not our mommy. Now, this was before September 11th, but it's still, you know, we got children on milk cartons and things like that, so strangers take that kind of thing seriously. You're not our mommy. Let go of us, you awful woman. And to this day, to try to get Agnes to talk about what went through her mind at that moment, she sputters and frequently becomes speechless. So a worker at the grocery store, meaning well, hears these cries from these obviously adorable, well-scrubbed, beautiful little children. And my poor, darling, flustered wife stands there until a member of the local police force comes over to interrogate her. Two members of the local police force, as a matter of fact, one younger, one older. Ma'am, are you these children's mother? Yes. Do you have any identification for them and for you? Yes. Look. You want to arrest me? Arrest me. Believe me, it'll be a relief. I'll get three hots and a cot, and my husband can deal with these little monsters. At which point the elder policeman grins a little bit and chuckles, and Joe Friday, the younger one, is still, you know, he's still very serious, and he looks over and goes, hey, you know, and you don't have kids, do you? Well, no. And the older cop looks at the younger cop and says, that's the mother. I know nothing about this. The two eldest and I finish our shopping, wheel our bags out to the family truckster, where Agnes is weeping, and tells me, so help me God,
if I ever go anywhere with you and these two again, it'll be a long, long time. Well, honey, what's wrong? Don't ask. Don't ask. Stupid me, I continue to ask, and she finally just lets it all go. It took weeks to get over that. Only now can we look back on it and laugh, and it is one of those, if you look back on it, you'll laugh kind of things. But there was nothing funny about it at the time. But that is in fact, our Thanksgiving adventure. One day I'll give it a better ending. And now, just to wrap it all up, the ultimate in Thanksgiving stories, never mind Indians, never mind turkeys. No, there's a massacre.
This song is called Alice's Restaurant. It's about Alice and the restaurant. But Alice's Restaurant is not the name of the restaurant. That's just the name of the song. And that's why I call the song Alice's Restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. Walk right in, it's around the back, just a half a mile from the railroad track. And you can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. Now it all started two Thanksgivings ago, it was on 2 years ago on Thanksgiving, when my friend and I went up to visit Alice at the restaurant. But Alice doesn't live in the restaurant, she lives in the church nearby the restaurant, in the bell tower, with her husband Ray and Foch as a dog. And living in the bell tower like that, they got a lot of room downstairs where the pews used to be. And having all that room, seeing as how they took out all the pews, they decided that they didn't have to take out their garbage for a long time. We got up there, we found all the garbage in there, and we decided it'd be a friendly gesture for us to take the garbage down to the city dump. So we took the half a ton of garbage, put it in the back of a red VW microbus, took shovels and rakes and implements of destruction, and headed on toward the city dump. Well, we got there, and there's a big sign and a chain across the dump saying closed on Thanksgiving. And we had never heard of a dump closed on Thanksgiving before. And with tears in our eyes, we drove off into the sunset looking for another place to put the garbage. We didn't find one till we came to a side road, and off the side of the side road was another 15-foot cliff. And at the bottom of the cliff was another pile of garbage. And we decided that one big pile is better than two little piles, and rather than bring that one up, we decided to throw ours down. That's what we did. Drove back to the church, had a Thanksgiving dinner that couldn't be beat, went to sleep and didn't get up until the next morning when we got a phone call from Officer Obie. He said, "Kid, we found your name on an envelope at the bottom of a half a ton of garbage, and wanted to know if you had any information about it." And I said, "Yes, sir, Officer Obie, cannot tell a lie. I put that envelope under that garbage." After speaking Obie for about 45 minutes on the telephone, we finally arrived at the truth of the matter and said that we had to go down and pick up the garbage, and also had to go down and speak to him at the police officer station. So we got in the red VW microbus with the shovels and rakes and implements of destruction, headed on toward the police officer station. Now, friends, there was only one or two things that Obie could have done at the police station, and the first was that he could have given us a medal for being so brave and honest on the telephone, which wasn't very likely, and we didn't expect it. Another thing was that it could have bombed us out and told us never to be seen driving garbage around the vicinity again, which is what we expected. But when we got to the police officer station, there was a third possibility that we hadn't even counted upon, and we was both immediately arrested, handcuffed. And I said, Obi, I don't think I can pick up the garbage with these handcuffs on. He said, shut up, kid. Get in the back of the patrol car, and that's what we did. Sat in the back of the patrol car and drove to the, quote, scene of the crime, unquote. I want to tell you about the town of Stockbridge, Massachusetts, where this happened here. They got three stop signs, two police officers and one police car. But when we got to the scene of the crime, there was five police officers and three police cars, being the biggest crime of the last 50 years, and everybody wanted to get in a newspaper story about it. And they was using up all kinds of cop equipment that they had hanging around the police officer station. They was taking plastic tire track footprints, dog smelling prints, and they took 27 8x10 color glossy photographs with circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back of each one explaining what each one was to be used as evidence against us. Took pictures of the approach, the getaway, the northwest corner, and southwest corner, and that's not to mention the aerial photography. After the ordeal, we went back to the jail. Obi said he was going to put us in the cell. Said, kid, I'm going to put you in the cell. I want your wallet and your belt. And I said, Obi, I can understand you want my wallet, so I don't have any money to spend in the cell, but what do you want my belt for? And he said, kid, we don't want any hangings. I said, Obi, did you think I was going to hang myself for littering? Obi said he was making sure, and friends Obi was, because he took out the toilet seat so I couldn't hit myself over the head and ground. And he took out the toilet paper so I couldn't bend the bars, roll the toilet paper out the window, slide down the roll, and have an escape. Obi was making sure, and it was about 4 or 5 hours later that Alice, remember Alice? It's a song about Alice. Alice came by and with a few nasty words to Obi on the side, bailed us out of jail. We went back to the church, had another Thanksgiving dinner that couldn't be beat, and didn't get up until the next morning when we all had to go to court. We walked in, sat down. Obi came in with the 27 8x10 covered glossy pictures with the circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back each one. Sat down. Man came in, said, all rise. We all stood up, and Obi stood up with the 27 8x10 covered glossy pictures, and the judge walked in, sat down with the C&I dog, and he sat down. We sat down. Obi looked at the C&I dog. Then the 27 8x10 covered glossy pictures with the circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back of each one, and looked at the C&I dog. And then the 27 8x10 colored glossy pictures with the circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back of each one, and began to cry, because Obi came to the realization that it was a typical case of American blind justice and there wasn't nothing he could do about it. And the judge wasn't going to look at the 27 8x10 colored glossy pictures with the circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back of each one explaining what each one was to be used as evidence against us. And we was fined $50 and had to pick up the garbage in the snow, but that's not what I came to tell you about. Came to talk about the draft. We got a building down New York City, it's called Whitehall Street, where you walk in, you get injected, inspected, detected, infected, neglected, and selected. I went down to get my physical examination one day, and I walked in, I sat down, got good and drunk the night before, so I looked and felt my best when I went in that morning. Because I wanted to look like the all-American kid from New York City. Man, I wanted to feel like that. I wanted to be the all-American kid from New York, and I walked in, sat down, I was hung down, brung down, hung up, and all kinds of mean, nasty, ugly things. And I walked in, I sat down, they gave me a piece of paper, said, kid, see the psychiatrist, room 604. And I went up there, I said, shrink, I want to kill. I want to kill.
I want to see blood and gore and guts and veins in my teeth. Eat dead, burnt bodies. I mean, kill. And I started jumping up and down, yelling, kill. And it started jumping up and down with me, and we was both jumping up and down, yelling, kill. And the sergeant came over, pinned the little arm, and set me down the hall, said, you're our boy. Didn't feel too good about it. Proceeded on down the hall, getting more injections, inspections, detections, neglections, and all kinds of stuff that they were doing to me at the thing there. And I was there for 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours. I was there for a long time, going through all kinds of mean, nasty, ugly things. And I was just having a tough time there. And they was inspecting, injecting every single part of me, and they wasn't leaving no part untouched. Proceeded through, and I when finally came to see the very last man, I walked in, sat down after a whole big thing there, and I walked up and said, what do you want? He said, kid, we only got one question. Have you ever been arrested? I proceeded to tell him the story of Alice's restaurant, Massacre, with full orchestration and five-part harmony and stuff like that, and then all the phenomena stopped me right there and said, kid, did you ever go to court? I proceeded to tell him the story of the 27 8x10 colored glossy pictures with the circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back of each one. It stopped me right there and said, kid, I want you to go over and sit down on that bench that says Group W. Now, kid. And I walked over to the bench there, and there's Group W is where they put you. If you may not be moral enough to join the army after committing your special crime, and there was all kinds of mean, nasty, ugly-looking people on the bench there. Mother rapers. Father stabbers. Father rapers sitting right there on the bench next to me, and one day was mean and nasty and ugly and horrible and crime-fighting guys are sitting there on the bench, and the meanest, ugliest, nastiest one, the meanest father raper of them all, was coming over to me, and he was mean and ugly and nasty and horrible and all kinds of things, and he sat down next to me and said, kid, what'd you get? Said, I didn't get nothing. I had to pay $50 and pick up the garbage. I said, what were you arrested for, kid? And I said, littering. And they all moved away from me on the bench there, and the hairy eyeball, all kinds of mean, nasty things, till I said, and creating a nuisance. And they all came back, shook my hand, and we had a great time on the bench talking about crime, mother stabbing, father raping, all kinds of groovy things that we were talking about on the bench. And everything.
And that's where we have to draw to a close. Thanks, everybody. Catch you Monday. And love those loved ones you're around, and love them well, and be thankful for them. Peace. And always, always, we think of you. RMR, Gina, it's all for you.
This is the Quality News Network. The 2008 Democratic presidential race is tightening, Barack Obama gaining on frontrunner Hillary Clinton 6 weeks before the first balloting. That's according to a Reuters Zogby poll released today. Ending months of speculation, officials with the state of New Hampshire announcing that their presidential primary will be held on January 8th. Iowa's caucuses have led the way for several decades, but New Hampshire has had the initial primary for even longer, since 1920. The announcement comes directly after the state of Michigan's decision to hold their primary on January 15th. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice says while she's looking forward to next week's Middle Eastern Peace Conference in Annapolis, Maryland, she's cautious about expecting too much from a fragile diplomacy. World powers will gather to promote a peace deal between the Israelis and Palestinians in order to gain some stability in the war-torn Middle East. Thousands of displaced Iraqis have begun returning to their homes, according to the BBC. An estimated 1,000 Iraqis make it back home daily because of a drop in violence, improved security, and incentives from the Iraqi government. Pakistani President General Pervez Musharraf may leave his military post as soon as this weekend. That's according to a top official. He'll then take the presidential oath as a civilian, satisfying a key directive by Western powers, including the White House. In Bangladesh, shelters and rescue camps overrun with victims of the country's worst storm in a decade. Food and water now running out. More bodies are being discovered. Thousands remain missing. British Prime Minister Gordon Brown apologized to the public today for a security breach affecting an estimated 25 million people across the United Kingdom. Two computer disks containing a bank account and personal information are lost in the largest breach of security of its kind in Europe. Airports and train stations across the U.S. packed with travelers today. A record 39 million Americans expected to travel at least 50 miles over this Thanksgiving holiday. And the French government and striking transit workers went back to the bargaining table today. President Nicolas Sarkozy warning saboteurs of the country's high-speed rail system that they would be punished with extreme severity. Strike has crippled France and costing the economy an estimated 500 million euros daily. You're listening to QNN.
Living our lives in a civil fashion is a declaration of intent. It says we are ready to put our better selves forward for the well-being of the community. It's like romance. When you fall in love, you are on your best behavior. The delight in making a loving connection with someone brings out the best in us, naturally. It is natural to acknowledge our fellow human beings with a nod of the head or a smile, to show them the respect we would want them to show us. The more we are civil with strangers and with those who already know us, the healthier a spirit we create for ourselves, for each other, and the surrounding community. George Washington, the founder of a great nation, declared, "Every action done in company ought to be with some sign of respect to those that are present." Civility is essential to community health. For more information, click on the Civility button on our website, qualitynewsnetwork.com.
University researchers say they've mapped the genetic code for two strains of drug-resistant tuberculosis. Doctors say understanding the way mutations work will assist in the effort to improve treatment of the disease. According to the Calorie Control Council, on Thanksgiving Day, the average American eats 4,500 calories and nearly 230 grams of fat. The Centers for Disease Control, meantime, report that American adults are exercising more. However, there is still room for more improvement, according to that study. Freddie Mac announcing a massive quarterly net loss of $2.3 billion. Government-sponsored mortgage company saying it was forced to set aside $1.2 billion to pay for home loans gone awry. Shares of Office Depot fell 6% after it announced its quarterly profit fell by 9%. And also retailer Limited Brands blamed unseasonably warm autumn weather for poor sales, a 48% plunge in quarterly profit, the result there. Abercrombie & Fitch posting a 15% boost in quarterly profit. Even sales were fairly flat at comparable stores. Light sweet crude oil trading at $97.29 a barrel. Gold at $798.60 an ounce. At today's close of Wall Street, the Dow down 211 points to end below 13,000 at 12,799. And there's always more at our website, qualitynewsnetwork.com. I'm Barbara Lewis.
Gather around the radio, kids. It's time for Strictly Confidential. It's the homosexual agenda on steroids, putting the dominionists and the loyal Bushies and the rest of America's underbelly on notice that the GLBT community is simply not going to take it anymore. So, just like gay kryptonite, here's Peter Godbold.
Good evening. evening, America, and good morning, world. Welcome to Book, Chapter, and Verse 76 of Strictly Confidential. I am Peter Godbold, and welcome to the LGBT version of Conversation Radio, exclusively on the listener-supported Head On Radio Network. Thank you for making Strictly Confidential a part of your day. Today is, in fact, Wednesday, November the 21st. If you are listening as shortly after 9 p.m. Eastern Time on a Wednesday, that is the 21st, you are indeed listening to a live show. This show is the eve of Thanksgiving. I was wondering about that earlier. You know, it's almost like science fiction. If you went to another planet and discovered a civilization that all ate the same animal on the same day and gave thanks, you'd probably think it was awfully strange. But, you know, it's a tradition. What can I tell you? I'm participating in it tomorrow myself, and I hope everyone has a safe and wonderful Thanksgiving Day tomorrow. The telephone number for the show is 877, the number 4 head on. That's 877-4 head on. It translates to 877-443-2366. This is indeed Conversation Radio, and you're welcome to call in and talk to myself and to the guest who I'll be introducing in just a moment. If you have unlimited long distance, please use 304-658-3333. That's 304-658-3333. That rings in West Virginia, and it will save the studio over the toll-free line. If you have unlimited long distance, that would be great. If not, we'll certainly pay the freight. The email arrives to Peter at headonradionetwork.com, and I do try to check the mail during the show if any questions or our listener comments come along. The show site is strictlyconfidentialradio.com, and there you're going to find links to all of the guests, as well as to the audio archives from the past shows, and to the chat room, which is active as I speak. You'll find links there to the main Head On Radio Network site. You can find out about the progressive programming on the Head On Radio Network. You'll find the contribute button there. It's a PayPal button on the headonradionetwork.com main page. You'll find links also for Strictly Confidential's MySpace page, which will assist you in locating music for the show. Our guest this evening was actually our guest Monday evening. It's just that it's D.C. LaRue. I'm thrilled to have him back again. It's just that I talked to D.C. so much about his history and how he got in the music business and this, that, and the other, that really we only got to play one of his tracks while he was with us on the air, which was his track called Cathedrals. After he left the show, we played Forces of the Night and Indiscreet, and I'll tell you, that's just the tip of the iceberg. Just to remind you, if you were not with us Monday evening, and you're certainly welcome to go back and listen to the show from Monday, it's archived at strictlyconfidentialradio.com. You'll find a link to the archive within the calendar date, within Monday's calendar date. D.C. LaRue was born David Charles LaRue in New Haven, Connecticut, and studied graphic design in college, and then went into the album sleeve design business. He designed album sleeves for John Lennon, Bruce Springsteen, Janis Ian, and a long list of folks. He saw that as a way of getting into the music industry through the back door, because he's always wanted to be a singer. I think that's very clever. His album work graphic designs won him two Paul Revere Awards. When D.C. LaRue did go into the music business in about 1976, his first smash was Cathedrals, and it prompted Cashbox magazine to say that Cathedrals is to disco what Blue Suede Shoes is to rock dance halls, and there's a lot of history there. He's also the only 12-inch single to be charted on Billboard magazine's top 100 singles chart before or after. So without any further delay, D.C., welcome back to the show this evening.
Thank you. It's delightful to be back.
I'm glad to have you. Yes, I can hear you fine. And you can hear me too?
Sure.
Good.
You know, with the cell phones, they fade in and out. I'm just concerned that you'll hear everything I say.
Thanks
for having me back. I enjoyed the chat we had the night before last. It was really a delight, you know, because you asked some really nice questions and I had some good answers, I guess, you know. I'm really an honest person. At my age, I just cut right to the chase, you know. I had a friend of mine who was listening. He said, "Boy, you just go on and on. You're so honest." I said, "Well, you know, I have nothing to lose. If you ask me a question, I'll give you an answer." The most of the time, Peter, is that sometimes, well, not most of the time, but sometimes people don't want to hear the answer. They would prefer that I say something that isn't true, or, you know, script the issue or say something that they want to hear. But I'm beyond that at this point in my life. I did that a lot when I was in the 70s when I was recording, you know. So I'm a little bit more liberated now.
Well, that's certainly a plus. Actually, on this show, we like to deal with the realities, and we want everyone to feel comfortable and to talk about themselves. We're all pretty much flat out. It's like a family around here. We pretty much are very likely to say most anything about anything. And so I'm glad you feel the spirit of the show. DC, before we jump right into the music, there are a couple of questions I sped you through toward the end of the show Monday that we really didn't go into any great depth. And that is about the movies. Now, you did soundtrack two songs for Thank God It's Friday. How did you get involved in the movie Thank God It's Friday? Because that was a huge hit.
Well, really simple. It was part of my deal with Casablanca. When the record company that I was recording for here in New York City, Pyramid Records, Pyramid Recording Company, they were an independent record company here in the city. But by the time my second album came out, The Tea Dance, they realized that they really couldn't handle... they were a real tiny label, and they didn't think they could handle my career, which seemed to be like mushrooming at the time. And so they wanted to keep their end of the production situation, but they didn't want to press and distribute records because they didn't feel they had the facility. So a deal was made between Pyramid Recording and Casablanca Records in the end of 1976, early 1977. And at the time, Casablanca was huge. I mean, it was the biggest independent record company in the world. It had Donna Summer, it had Kiss. It had, on and on. It had Cher. It was a giant. Village People, on and on. They just owned the charts. And their biggest foray in the music business was their disco business. And so when the deal was made for me to make that transition from Pyramid to Casablanca, it was right at that very moment that they were putting together the soundtrack for Thank God It's Friday. And I remember the guy who headed up Pyramid said, "Well, what you're going to be going over to Casablanca, and you'll be leaving, blah 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 blah." And I remember I got on the plane. I lived in New York City, and they had made arrangements for me to move to the West Coast and have a place there, whatever. And I arrived in Los Angeles. The night that I arrived, a limousine picked me up, and it took me to a party in Beverly Hills, and all the people from the movie and Filmworks division of Casablanca was there, and it was a party. The lawyers who were putting together the deal for Thank God It's Friday, you know, it's all lawyers, and I wonder how they ever get to make a movie in Hollywood. It's so much about everything else. But you know, the people from Motown was there, and Diana Ross was there, and Donna Summer was there, and it was a thrill. I mean, it was really like a dream come true. I landed in Los Angeles, and the limousine picked me up and whisked me to a party in Beverly Hills. And Neil Bogart walked over to me, who was the president of Casablanca, and he greeted me, and he said, "Well," he said, "you know, you're just in time. We're deciding on what's going on to the soundtrack. Do you want to write a couple of tunes?" And I was supposed to begin the third album, with Bob Esty at the time, the Confessions recording. So that was postponed for a couple of months while I wrote the songs for Thank God It's Friday. And that's how it happened. It was just one thing led to another. It was very exciting. And I remember very well. And it really was. It was like a fantasy. It was just like this fantasy come true. I mean, all these stories that you heard about Hollywood and movies and Beverly Hills and limousines, and it was all there, and it was all very real for me for the next 3 years while I was out in California with Casablanca. So that's how it happened. It was just part of, it just became a part of the transition from Pyramid to Casablanca.
Well, what were the tracks that you wrote for the movie, and also how did they explain to you the scenes that they would appear in? Did you have some prior knowledge?
It was real simple. One of the tracks was called Do You Want the Real Thing, and they had already shot the scene, and they had used Love to Love You Baby they have a soundtrack there already. They had like at the time it was like a click track with a beat per minute kind of situation, that they would, when they finally decided on the actual song, they would then just drop that into the soundtrack. And so they said, well, here's the scene. It's the scene of the disco. It's late, sleazy. The song we have in place now is What's the Lovely Baby, so we'd like to have you do something with that BPM. And so that's the approach that you have to take to that tune. And the other tune, they had already done the sequence of the guy and drag in the men's room, or in the ladies' room. I forget what, it's a long time since I saw the movie, but there was one scene, I think it was a guy getting dragged to go out on the dance floor, and he was putting on his makeup and his girdle or something in the men's room. I don't know, I think it was the men's room. And they had to click that track, and they had the beats per minute, and they said, and here's this guy, you know, part of this disco when he's getting into drag and he's going out and blah, blah, blah. And so I figured, you know, okay, no, I have to write something static. So I wrote, you can always tell a lady from the company she keeps, you know, and that was pretty much about, you can always tell a real woman from a drag by the things that she does during the night if you listen to the lyric, you know. And so those are how they came about. I was pretty much directed, you know, as to what they wanted me to do, how fast the tunes were supposed to be, and pretty much a lyrical concept. So wasn't all freeform. It, you know, I had a direction to go in.
Well, that's very interesting, actually, that they specified it down to the BPM. I guess the guys cutting the movie knew
exactly.
Yeah,
they did. Yeah, down to the BPM, sure.
And there was another flick. Go ahead.
Oh, I guess that they have these, you know, especially with that film, it's so music oriented. That's the way they did it, you know, just the way they did it. And you're going to ask about Sergeant Pepper. Sergeant Pepper was one of those things. They just got every big name in Hollywood to make an appearance throughout the film. And I mentioned the other night that, you know, these weren't the speaking roles or anything. They were just, you know, cameos, or, you know, on screen, off screen, just so they could add another name to the credits, the roles, the credits.
So you didn't sing. I was trying to figure out.
I remember when I said I was in Sergeant Pepper, my mom went to see the movie. She said, I didn't get to see you. I said, oh, yes, I was there. My name's on the ground. There's the very end of the crowd scene with all, I'm right there next to Carol Channing and Frankie Valli. So it was that kind of thing. And the same thing with Can't Stop the Music. Alan Carr, who was the producer, was a big fan of mine. And although I didn't have a speaking part in the film or anything, he really loved my music. And I didn't know that. You know, at the time, I didn't know it. And the film was put together. And then my friend Felipe Rose from Village People. I'm still friendly with a couple of people from Village People, Felipe and Randy Jones, the original Village People, the cowboy, lives around the corner from me here in the city, and we're still in touch. And I remember Felipe said to me, I didn't know, you know, Alan Carr was such a big DC the Roof fan because he wants to put you in the scene when The Office is the Neil Bogart character and the various, but it wasn't anything super, super cameo, you know, or something to add to my resume. I was really just out there to make music. It sounds glamorous, but it was real, just, you know, cut and dried.
Well, one thing I neglected to ask you Monday, and she's one of my favorite people, Sharon, how many times have you been loved before, Red? Apparently you've worked with her. I'd love to hear your impressions of Sharon, Sharon Red, and some of the, do you have any stories about her? She is remarkable.
Well, she was a tremendously talented lady. I don't know how many people are fans of hers. I mean, it's a shame. She was one of the original harlots with Bette Midler. Her was in Manchester. And Barry Manilow played piano. And I remember going to see Bette Midler out in the hall of Paramus in the early 70s, Paramus, New Jersey. And I met Bette. I was there with a friend of mine, Peter Silberman, who had booked her. He was the booking guy for the Continental Baths, with Steve Ostro, who owned the Continental Baths. And, you know, that was Bette's big break, quote-unquote, is when she sang at the Continental Baths. And Peter Silberman and his wife broke me out. You got to hear this woman, Bette Midler. And I said, okay. So we hopped into his convertible and we drove out to Paramus, New Jersey. And she sang in the theater. She was like a shopping mall theater, you know, where they played the movies. She had two shows that evening. And it was on a weekend. And I'll tell you something. I can remember the moment like it was yesterday. Bette Midler was just... She sang Delta Dawn, and it was like a three-piece combo, and the harlot and her. It just knocked me out. She was, I guess, and I would say she still is. I mean, she was just incredible. I mean, that woman in person, I'll tell you, nothing's like her. And then we went backstage with Peter, and I met Barry Manilow, and I met Sharon Redd, and we became kind of friendly. And then when the time came to do the recording, all Sharon Redd was also friendly with Annie Sutton, who was Aaron Sheffrem's girlfriend, and he got Annie to do the background vocals. And then Annie called Sharon. Of course, Sharon and I had known each other, and so she was on the recording. And then shortly thereafter. And it's interesting, these people, they weren't disco, and they weren't really thinking about becoming disco singers and this and that, but disco got so big, and Sharon got to work so much from being on my recording, you know, she got hired so much that she ultimately got a deal with Prelude, and then she started making dance records herself. And, you know, she's passed away. It's been a while now, you know, since she left us, but real talented woman. And, you know, we lost a lot of people. I mean, another one that I really adored, and she was the sweetest girl in town, was Vicki Sue Robinson. And I was so heartbroken when she passed. I mean, oh, boy. She used to appear at one of the cabarets here in the Village. And every time she was there, we'd get together. We had the best time. When I would perform, I remember I did a show with Vicki Sue and Savannah Band and whatever down in Atlanta, Georgia. Ah, she was a delight. She was the best. She was such fun.
Trying to remember for our listeners some of the tracks that Vicki Sue did. Now, she did the, if I'm not mistaken, the remake of To Sir With Love, and also, what was
turn
the other
Turn the Beat Around.
Yes, that.
Turn the Beat Around and Hold Tight. She had a couple of big hits, yeah.
Did she do Everlasting Love also, I think?
I don't remember. She may have done it later in her career, but that wasn't, you know, her first big hit was Hold Tight, and then the smash of Rudy, which everybody loves and is familiar with, was Turn the Beat Around, you know. And yeah, had a couple of the hits, you know. But so that's Sharon Redd. You're a Sharon Redd fan, huh? You have a lot of her stuff? You have her recordings?
Yes, I used to play Sharon Redd regularly back when I was DJing in the 80s. She was always one of my favorites, absolutely. And In the Name of Love, of course, was a wonderful track, too.
Big hit.
Remarkable. Well, I'm not going to keep you talking about these any longer. I do want to get into music. I realize you can stay with us about an hour for the first half of the show this evening. I'm noticing some of the music that you've sung along.
I was disappointed. You know, just before we continue, I thought that I was hoping that I would get some email from the listeners. I mean, I thought I would go to my email the next day from my website and see a whole bunch of the people out there listening, emailing me and telling me how they like the show. So I just want to say before I have to end the interview, to all those people listening up there, go to my website and send me an email and tell me what you think of the music and tell me what you think of the interview. I would like to know whether a lot of listeners know who I am or whether they're just getting an introduction to my music as we speak and you're playing it now, whether I'm picking up a new audience or whether there are people out there from the 70s who are listening who, frenzy of remembering kind of thing from back in the day. And, you know, the email address is there on the website. It's dclarue@dclarue.org, or you can just go to the website, www.dclarue.org. But I would really appreciate hearing from people who are out there listening, because it means a great deal for me. I like to go into the email in the morning and look at the mail and see how people are reacting to my music and my career and the website and whatever. So I'd appreciate from any people out there listening, I'd appreciate an email contact. You know, reach out. It'd be really nice.
Well, I encourage them to do that also. You are a remarkable person with such a history. It just makes sense to me. And DC LaRue DC. It's www.dclarue.org to get to the site. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. And also,
an
you can find the
right there.
Yeah, and you can find that also at strictlyconfidentialradio.com. You'll just go to today's calendar date if you can locate it by going through Strictly Confidential, also dclarue.org, and you can locate the email address. Some of the music that you have sent, DC, is not dated in the 1970s, and it's not dated in the 80s. In fact, it's dated in the 2000s. What's up with this new stuff that I've gotten from you? Edge of the Night is one track that comes to mind.
Well, when I stopped recording in the early 80s, I had really decided that I was not going to be recording anymore. I mean, I really had it. And I felt I had done the best I could. I had a 5-year role. I had 5 albums. I had a lot of success. And the way the music industry had changed, I mean, it was so anti-disco, and, you know, they were burning disco records tonight. And I really felt abused, and I really felt very bad for myself. I'm very sorry for myself because I had really done, I really felt I had made some, at the time, and I don't feel this way anymore. I have to say I've changed because things have changed. But I felt really bad, and I felt that I didn't get the credit I deserved, and I had worked very hard, and I had given it everything I had. And to be treated like such garbage in 1982, I mean, I'll tell you something. I felt really abused. And I had decided, forget it. I said, I'm going to go back to art direction and design and photography, and I'm not going to bother with the music industry or disco or recording ever again. And I kept my promise until the early 90s, about 99, 2000, I met this kid, Adam Goldstone, who was a DJ here in New York City, and I'm kind of a kid in his early 30s, and he was such a fan. I mean, I'll tell you something. And I was doing art direction. I was doing all the advertising, in-store display work, and stuff, promotional stuff for HMV record stores here in New York City. And I met Adam at the record store that he worked in on 86th Street and Lexington Avenue here, and he just was, I mean, he was so excited about working with me and meeting me, and he got a deal with a record company in England called Newphonic, and he approached me. He had my cell phone number, and he approached me. He said, "Listen," he said, "I want to record you so much. And he said, will you please do a record for me?" And you know, he was such a sweet kid, and he was so excited, and he was such a fan, you know, and he really loved my music so much that I couldn't say no to him. So we did Edge of the Night. I think it was 2002 or whatever. I'd have to look at the record, but it was early this decade. And I'll tell you something. I'm not sorry I did it. I mean, he passed away. I mean, these guys, you know, he passed away about a year and a half ago at a trance marathon weekend in out in the Midwest somewhere, and he had done too many drugs, and he passed out in the shower, and he collapsed, and something gross, and something awful, an ugly thing. But
yeah.
he made the best record with me, and I listened to him. He gave me direction. I wrote the song with him, and Edge of the Night is the outcome. And it was a really great recording. And as luck would have it, and this is the shame, because what happened is that, as luck would have it, when his album came out, which was called Lower East Side Stories, and it was released in London, in England, in the UK, and it was only out for 2 or 3 months, and the record company went out of business. And then shortly thereafter, Adam passed away, a dreadful accident. And so the track is just sat there doing nothing. But I really loved it, and I'm not sorry I did it, and I'm glad he approached me to do it. And I, when I listen to it now, I'm really, I get excited about it because it came out really nice. And bottom line is that for anybody who's interested in my music and any kind of musical evolution I have, may have, gone through to bring myself up to date into the year 2001 or whatever, that's a good track to listen to, because it's pretty much, I'm still very honest with the lyrics. I cut through the crap. It's, you know, it's very little bullshit, and it's a very serious story about you know, like sexuality and relationships, and I really love it. I'm very proud of it. And so that's how
wonderful.
It happened. You know, even though I said I would never make another record, I made another record. But it wasn't a comeback record, because I'm not trying to stage a comeback, you know, but it was a favor for a friend that turned out very, very well.
Well, I have to say that, quite frankly, between Glenn Rivera and myself, we're hoping you do make a comeback, to be perfectly honest with you.
I had an offer recently to perform again in to do some England and London and Paris and Tokyo, and I'm considering it for the spring. I have to be honest, and there's another. I haven't performed in 15 or 20 years, and but you know, I don't know, with this website and with this, there's a whole change in attitude about disco music from the 70s, and it's got a new effect, and it's getting a new lots of the people who come into my website are kids. You know, they're in their early 20s, and which I was very surprised at. So, and I guess I would consider performing again. I come back now. I thought my whole focus is changed. I'm a photographer now, and I do photography, and I love it, and I don't have a problem with it. And on occasion, I would do performance or something. I really, but honestly, Peter, I don't plan on making another record. I don't. I don't think I need to. I think I pretty much said it all. You know.
I see. Well. Nonetheless, we would like to run Edge of the Night, and thank you for introducing it for us. Is it all right if we run that now, DC?
Sure, you can play. It's fun.
I'd love to hear it. Bob, if you'd run the DC LaRue track, Edge of the Night. Thank you. DC, I really like the track. It reminds me of Cathedrals in a lot of ways. Were you influenced?
Adam, I didn't really want to go there, but Adam insisted, and so I went along with him. He wanted something dark and moody and sinister and whatever, and I said, okay. He wanted it very much like the Cathedrals, because, I mean, he just thought the Cathedrals was the best, and he wanted to evoke the same kind of mood, the same kind of feeling, the same kind of reality, the same kind of sexuality, and so that's what we did. I mean, it was intentional, so you picked up the right vibe.
It's a very good track, and I can see where he would want you to do an updated version, or an up to something with that same theme or that darkness, because Cathedrals was, of course, a major hit, as everyone knows. Is this available, this particular track, available at the D.C. LaRue store?
Yes, it's available at the D.C. LaRue store. It's on a compilation there. It's called Wicked Youth. It's on one of the compilations. I think that's probably, maybe there's maybe you can buy the CD as an import online if you want to hear the whole Adam Goldstone CD. You can do a search on Google for Adam Goldstone, Goldstone, and the album is called Lower East Side Stories. But if you just want that track, you can pick it up by going to the DC LaRue store at my website, and you can buy the compilation CD there, the Wicked Youth CD. And that Wicked Youth CD also has a couple of other unreleased tracks. It's got a duet that I do with Lou Christie that was never released, and it has a ballad that I did with the Harlem Boys Choir that was never released. So it's a pretty decent CD collection.
And that's at that particular, you can click within www.dclarue.org to find that, right?
Yeah, and then you just click on the store. There's a link right from the website to the store, the DC LaRue store. So, it takes a minute.
Well, you mentioned the Harlem Choir, and in my reading, I've associated that with the track "Good Morning, My Love," which I listened to the other day, and I think it's beautiful. This was not released except for the CD.
Yeah, well, when I was with Casablanca, everything I did was released except two tracks, and one of them was called "Love Is an Emotion." And the other one was called "Good Morning, My Love." The stuff that was independently, separately, and we never got—it was never released. One thing led to another, and we never got it released. But there were two tracks, and "Good Morning, My Love" happens to be one of my favorite all-time records that I ever made in my life. I mean, it's a ballad, and it's not typical of something that I was famous for at the time. But it's such an honest song about getting up in the morning across from somebody that you're really in love with. And once again, it's a real deal lyric. I mean, it's just an honest, honest lyric. And I think it really is. Says a lot about a real honest relationship and a valid loving relationship. And if you love somebody in the morning, you really love them, when they're jumping out of bed and they've got bad breath and their hair is a mess. And this is about that, and it's about that sharing that moment. And and then as an afterthought, we added the Boys Choir of Harlem because a friend of mine knew the choir director at the time, and who I think has passed away, Russell Turnbull. And he said to me, I bet you I could get the Boys Choir of Ireland to do the background vocals for a donation. And I said, well, you want to try? You can try. And he made a big donation to the Boys Choir of Harlem, and we got a bus, and we bussed them into the studio, and they did, these little boys did the background vocals. And it's just as pretty as can be. They sound like angels. And I really love that track, and that's really unavailable. Well, except for the CD, the Wicked Youth CD, which is available on the website. But I love it, and that's one of the I don't play my own music, but when I do play something that I've done myself, for whatever reason, I seem to play that one, and I throw that one on and play it.
Wonderful. Well, I'm sure everyone would love to hear it, and I'd love to hear it again. And in fact, you are right, DC. It is a wonderful track. Bob, if you'd roll the DC LaRue track, Good Morning, My Love. That is marvelous, and the choir just gives it such a flair. It's really
wonderful. I hate to say, I was just sitting here listening to it, and I said, "Boy, that's such a good record." It's such a shame it never got released, huh?
Well, yes, I agree. I agree with you that unfortunately, it is available on Wicked Youth there at www.dclarue.org. And it occurred to me that we ought to explain that DC LaRue is spelled.
I don't want to talk to you, but I love the song so much. I often think about maybe trying to get Barry Manilow or Whitney Houston to record it, because I think the song, even though it was never a hit for me, I think the song is such a real deal song, I just it's like one of those things where I listen to it and I say, well, I wouldn't change a thing. I wouldn't change, like the T-Dance I mentioned the other night, that's my favorite recording, because from beginning to end it's exactly how I envisioned it, and I wouldn't change a note. And the same thing with Good Morning, My Love. From the beginning of that record to the end of the record, I wouldn't change one thing. It's just flawless. And it's not because it's mine. It's because all the people, you go in to make a record, and it's not just you. It's all on that recording. It's all real musicians, and it's all the boys choir singing, and it's the engineer, and it's the guitar player, and it's all those things, when I say it's a perfect record and I really love it, it's an appreciation of all the effort by all the other people, all the effort that went into making that record, the record that I perceived it to be, and having it work out just perfectly well, you know. And in the scheme of things, that doesn't really happen very often, I don't think. And I think if you speak with any performer or recording artist or whatever, I mean, I think the best of them can say, you know, in their entire recording careers that there's only been a few recordings that, you know, have evolved and been, you know, ended up exactly the way they perceived they were going to be. I mean, you know, it's an imperfect world and you don't always get what you want.
Well, it was an inspired idea to have the choir, and I was going to point out that I think if some of the listeners don't know, we should spell that D.C. LaRue is D-C-L-A-R-U-E, so it's www.dclarue.org. D.C., it's 9:50, and I promised I wouldn't keep you past the top of the hour, so maybe if you'd like to introduce another track, we'll go ahead and run that and then go to the news after it completes. But honestly, I don't know which one to pick. I'm torn between so many. I think you better do it. Do you happen to have a track list in front of
you? What do you got there to use?
We have not heard Faces of Love, nor have we heard Let Them Dance, nor Do You Want the Real Thing, Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, the Hot Jungle Drums and Voodoo Rhythms.
I would suggest saying Let Them Dance, only because, as I mentioned to you the other night, that seems to be the record that's getting all the play on satellite radio, on internet radio. If you go and if you key in Let Them Dance, D.C. LaRue on Google, you come up with all these playlists on all these disco internet stations, and you know, they're playing it on Sirius satellite radio, and they're playing it on KTU here in New York City, and in as much as Cathedrals was the first big hit and established me, and I mentioned this the other night, I think Let Them Dance is more palatable, and it's more of an obvious disco dance record that reflects the era. And it seems to be of all my past recordings, it seems to be the one that's getting all the airplay. That one and Hot Jungle Drums and Voodoo Rhythm, which was another hit that I had in the 70s. But Hot Jungle Drums gets a lot of, that gets a lot of play too. It kind of amazes me. But Let Them Dance is the winner, so I think if you wanted to go out with something, I would go out with Let Them Dance.
Well, then we'll definitely do that. And it is interesting that even though many people dare not say the word disco, it is seeming, I see a resurgence of it. Every time I turn around, I'm finding it being played somewhere.
It's all changed, and that's why I think earlier I said I'm not upset or resentful anymore, and I don't feel that way anymore because I have lived to see the day 35 years later that the whole disco thing has come around where it's getting respect, it's getting, not just me, it's the whole genre that's getting the kind of recognition it deserves and for the contributions that it made to the music industry. Disco music and the electronic things and the studio stuff and the synthesizer stuff and the inroads and the innovations that disco music made in the recording studio, relative to recording techniques and synthesizers and digital recording and the whole thing, changed the entire music industry from country music to classical music. And for years and years, and without disco, I don't want to go on and on because you want to play that record, but without disco, there would be no hip-hop and there would be no rap. End of story. It's the end of that. It would never have evolved into the dance. Without dance music, without disco music, the evolution musically would have never occurred. There would never be rap music or hip-hop music without disco. Period. End of story. There's no argument. And for years, even with rap being so big, disco never got the credit that it got deserved. But now it's different. And for some reason, it's happened in the last two or three or four years. And I see it, and I feel it, and so I've lived to see, like I said, I've lived to see the day, 35 years later, that the whole vibe, the whole attitude, the feeling about disco has changed, and it's just come 360, and now it's as positive as can be. And I can't tell you how delighted I am, because, I mean, I feel vindicated. It's like, see there, I've lived to see it, and I told you so. So I'm real happy. And you're right.
Good for you, DC. You
right,
tell them.
By saying that.
I think it's wonderful. And DC, we're going to run the track next, and then we'll go to the news at when the track completes. And DC, I appreciate your spending so much time with us on the show, And you are welcome to return as a guest in the future anytime you have. Just want to pick up the phone and call the show. I'll put you right on. You don't have to have a special invitation. And we've really enjoyed having you here.
Well, it's been terrific. It's been a lot of fun, Peter, because I haven't done any. There's one interview that I did about 2 months ago, but it was my first interview in like 20 years. And this is my second interview. And I'm agreed to do another interview with a online. It's called Disco Style. www.discostyle.com. DISCOSTYLE. And I've agreed to do an interview with them. But see, once again, it's like these interviews are, the people are calling me up and wanting to talk to me about disco. And I think it's solely because it's not me or so much a re-interest in my music, but it's a re-interest in the genre. And the people who are still around and cognizant, and not brain dead, you know, to talk about it and to give some insight into what it was and how it evolved. And I think I'm delighted. So you're my second interview in 20 years, but I'm planning on doing a third one, and then I'll see what happens, you know?
Well, it could be the start of a comeback, DZ. I hate to tell you, you've sworn not to do it, but it sounds like three interviews in a row is the start of a comeback to me.
Well, it's not a comeback. It's just a re-interest. No, I'm just having fun with it, but it's not. Believe me, it's not something. I'm not going to make any new recordings, and maybe I'll perform, you know, at a club or two just to have a good time for people who would like to see me and want to drag me out, you know, shake my bones. But you know, but that's about it. I don't envision myself at my age doing any new recordings or saying anything new or staging any kind of spectacular comeback. It's like I said, I'm a photographer, and I love my work, and I love being a photographer, and I have a wonderful time doing it. It's very creatively fulfilling and very gratifying, and so that's about that. So, but thank you so much for inviting me to talk with you. I mean, I've had a great time. I can't
thank you. I've enjoyed myself thoroughly. You're a remarkable guest, and have a great Thanksgiving tomorrow, DC.
Well, I sure would wish the same to you and all the listeners out there. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving holiday and a wonderful holiday season, Christmas and New Year's and Hanukkah and whatever, okay?
And thank you. And everyone, drop him an email. It's dclarue at
dclarue. Yeah, let me hear from you guys. Let me know you're alive. Let me know that I'm talking to somebody when I do these interviews, okay?
Absolutely.
I promise to answer every email personally. You know, it may take me a couple of days, but I'll get to it and I'll reply. I'll sit down on the computer and do it myself.
Wonderful. That's DC LaRue at dclarue.org. And thank you again, DC, and good evening to you, sir. And amazing guest. He was referred to us. DC was referred to us through our friend Glenn Rivera. I tell you, between Glenn Rivera and our friend Ernest Cole, who referred the guest last evening, who was Stan Harrison. We're really seeing a remarkable side and unheard of side of the music business that we just don't know about. So what we'll do is we'll run the track that we just talked about, which is the DC LaRue track Let Them Dance, which is apparently being played on Sirius, and we certainly can't let Sirius outdo us. We're going to run Let Them Dance, and then when we come back, I'll say a couple of words and we'll go to the news. Thank you, Bob. And that was the track, Let Them Dance, from D.C. LaRue. I received a couple of emails there during the while the track was playing. One is from one of our black listeners who is asking about D.C.'s comments regarding disco being the start of rap. I can explain to you the reference that was being what he's talking about there. When he released the track called Indiscreet, it was a 12-inch. I think it was 1976. Yes, it was 1976. Rapper Grandmaster Flash, who is an old-school rapper, you can see his videos on YouTube, it's Grandmaster Flash, was quoted as saying it was the first hip-hop break I'd ever heard and the start of hip-hop and rap beats to come. So I think that's what DC was referring to, just so that I can explain that. And then there's another email complaining that my interviews are too long. Look, they're not going to get any shorter. whatever. Okay, let me tell you about my guests this coming week before we go to the news. Monday, we have a remarkable guest, Bishop John Spong. And he is a progressive theologian and a remarkable Bible scholar and a prolific author. He's the author of the book, Why Christianity Must Change or Die. I'm very much looking forward to talking to the bishop. This coming Tuesday, after the holidays, we'll have Dan Gonzalez. Now, Dan is an ex-gay survivor. He went through hell, and he's done several critiques of some studies, and we're looking forward to having Dan with us. Wednesday night is free, and Thursday night we'll have Steve Skinner along with Ernest Cole, who are both legends in the music business, and looking forward to talking to them. And then, very special, next week on Friday, we have Gus and Elmer. Now, Gus and Elmer have been together 62 years. They are very likely the longest, the gay couple that's been together longer than any other living couple in the world. I believe one is in his early 90s and the other late 80s, or they may both be in their 90s now. They live in their home. And they take care of each other. They're doing well, and I'm thrilled to have Gus and Elmer on the show. They go back all the way back to the war. They met as soldiers, and it's a remarkable story and rich with LGBT history, and I know you'll want to join us for that. And, yeah, that's all I need to say before. And so as we come up on the news, this is Strictly Confidential. My name is Peter Godbold, and you're listening to the Head On Radio Network.
You're not the first to try it.
This is the Quality News Network. The war in Afghanistan has reached crisis proportions as the Taliban gain in numbers in more than half the country, closing in on the capital city of Kabul. An independent think tank whose members live in country completed a new study. Results indicate that if NATO is to have any impact against an insurgency, troop numbers will have to be doubled to at least 80,000. Ending months of speculation, officials with the state of New Hampshire announcing that their presidential primary will be held on January 8th. Iowa's caucuses have led the way for several decades, but New Hampshire has had the initial primary for even longer, since 1920. The announcement comes directly after the state of Michigan's decision to hold their primary on January 15th. The 2008 Democratic presidential race is tightening, Barack Obama gaining on frontrunner Hillary Clinton 6 weeks before the first balloting. That's according to a Reuters Zogby poll released today. Airports and train stations across the U.S. were packed with travelers today. A record 39 million Americans were expected to travel at least 50 miles this Thanksgiving holiday. Thousands of displaced Iraqis have begun returning to their homes, according to the BBC. An estimated 1,000 Iraqis make it back home daily because of a drop in violence, improved security, and incentives from the Iraqi government. In Islamabad, Pakistan, sports hero Imran Khan and hundreds more political prisoners freed today as martial law eased throughout the country's capital city. President General Pervez Musharraf may leave his military post as soon as this weekend. That's according to a top official under pressure from President Bush. British Prime Minister Gordon Brown apologized to the public today for a security breach affecting an estimated 25 million people across the UK. Two computer disks lost in the largest breach of security of its kind in Europe. Disgraced American cyclist Floyd Landis making a final appeal to French arbitrators to clear his name, possibly to regain the 2006 Tour de France title. He's accused of testing positive for testosterone during last year's race. Landis is banned from the sport for 2 years and stripped of his title. You are listening to the Quality News Network. We'll take a look at science and business news just ahead, but first, this message.
I know your secret. Nobody told me, but I know. Every time your little girl wants you to read her a story and you tell her you're too busy, I know. When your boy needs help with homework and you tell him to ask his mother, I know. Your wife asks you whether the warranty is still good on the broken dishwasher and you tell her you're too tired to look for it, I know. You're very good at keeping the secret, but it does take a lot of effort to keep the charade going. It could be very scary and embarrassing if anyone found out. But I know your secret. You can't read. Neither can 93 million American adults. You're in big company. Instead of running scared, become a hero in your own family. Find a local literacy program at your library. It's free. The day you whisper in your wife's ear, "Honey, I can read," just watch how big her smile is.
This message on literacy has been brought to you as a public service by the Quality News Network. For more information, please contact your local library. Using rapid bursts of magnetic energy is an effective treatment for serious depression. That's according to a large-scale study. It is considered safe and a viable alternative to both electroshock therapy and antidepressant drugs. Japan's prime minister unveiling a $2 billion aid package to assist developing Asian nations to fight pollution and combat climate change. The initiative includes grants, soft loans, and training programs over 5 years to tackle global warming and foster economic development. Freddie Mac announcing a massive quarterly net loss of $2.3 billion. The mortgage company says it was forced to set aside $1.2 billion to pay for home loans that went bad. Retailer Limited Brands blaming unseasonably warm autumn weather for poor sales and a 48% plunge in quarterly profit. The Ohio-based company lowered its financial outlook as well. Abercrombie and Fitch posting a 15% boost in quarterly profit, even though sales were fairly flat at comparable stores. Light sweet crude oil trading at $97.29 a barrel. Gold at $798.60 an ounce. At today's close of Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average down, plunging 211 points to end at 12,799. NASDAQ down 34 points. S&P 500 off 23. More at our website, qualitynewsnetwork.com. I'm Barbara Lewis.
And he's back, riding across America on a horse named Strictly Confidential, a man who knows his way around a pair of chaps. Here's your host, Peter Godbold.
And we're back for the second hour of Strictly Confidential on the Head On Radio Network. I am Peter Godbold. That's my story, and I am sticking to it. The toll-free line is 877, the number 4 Head On. That's 877, the number 4 Head On. Or if you have unlimited long distance, you could use that and save the studio some money. That's 304-658-3333. That rings in West Virginia. Mail arrives to Peter at headonradionetwork.com. We are indeed in Turkey Eve this evening. Tomorrow we will be some tired puppies by tomorrow afternoon. Some of our listeners are postponing Thanksgiving till Friday, some till Saturday because of late guest arrivals. So the ones of us who are doing it tomorrow will most likely be eating turkey soup by the time they get to their main dish. But I hope everyone has a safe and happy time with their families and their friends, and to give thanks for what's left of this country anyway, the pieces that have not been destroyed. And oh, how I want that man impeached. It's just more than I can take some days. You know, there was a article, and it was sent to me last evening by our news ninja, Gene, and I very much appreciated it. And in fact, Bob mentioned it to me this evening in production chat as being a great story. And of course, I didn't get to it, but last night we had our guest Stan with the wonderful music program from last evening. But you gotta love this. You just gotta love it. Most of you, anyway, have heard of Conservapedia. It is the lame hope to establish their worldview of everything's bad except what we think view of the conservatives versus Wikipedia. And of course, Wikipedia is way too liberal and too open. Too many professors contributing to it. Too many people of like minds sharing the truth. Now, of course, not all of Wikipedia is absolutely accurate. It's a work in progress, and it always will be, which is the beautiful thing about it. But much to my horror, someone told me about Conservapedia a while back. If you'd like to visit the site, you're welcome to. But it's at conservapedia.com. And in any case, this is the story of Conservapedia. You're going to love this. There are 45,000, slightly over 45,000 total pages in the Conservapedia database. Now, that's generous because that includes the talk pages. Now, talk pages are just pages about Conservapedia. They're not pages regarding any subject other than the inner workings of Conservapedia. That 45,000 also represents what they call minimal stub pages, which are just pages with a couple of links on it, or coming soon. And other pages that don't really qualify as content. So out of the 45,000 total pages, there are actually 19,000, I'm rounding these off, pages that have, quote, legitimate content. Now, regarding files, there's about 6,000 files that have been uploaded that you can download. Now, the thing about it is that there's been a total of 37 million page views for Conservapedia. I'm rounding it off. And then there's a listing for page edits, which is kind of irrelevant. And but here's what blew me away. Gene just blew me away with this. And by the way, Bob pointed out in chat that this is being covered on the homepage also of WD-40. this is what they're interested in. I'm about to tell you what... You're not going to believe this. I'm about to tell you what the top 10 pages are in Conservapedia. These conservatives are interested in one thing and one thing only. Just amazes me. The number one page is, of course, the main page. You type in Conservapedia, it takes you to the home page of Conservapedia, so obviously that will always remain the number one page as being the opening page. Almost 2 million views of that. Okay. Now for actual content, okay. The number two site, homosexuality within Conservapedia. The next site, number three in popularity, homosexuality and hepatitis. The fourth track in Conservapedia, or rather the fourth article or page that has the most hits, is homosexuality and promiscuity. The fifth most observed page in the Conservapedia is, and this stumped me, gay bowel syndrome. Now, that's a new one on me. I don't really think I care to know much about it, if there is any such thing. But I'm sure they've got some conservative doctors who have. I mean, I know about irritable bowel and bitchy bowel. Maybe they mean bitchy. Okay, fifth most popular page within Conservapedia, gay bowel syndrome. The sixth most popular page in Conservapedia would be homosexuality and parasites. I'm as serious as a heart attack. The seventh most popular page, homosexual couples and domestic violence. Are you picking up a trend here, my friends? The eighth most popular page, homosexuality and gonorrhea. The ninth most popular page, in Conservapedia, Homosexuality and Mental Health. And at number 10, now this is just number 10 for today. Yesterday, number 10 was Homosexuality and Mental Health, which has moved up to number 9 today, and a couple of other movements in the chart. But there's no difference in the content. Each one is exactly the same topic, just a couple have moved. Today's number 1, our number 10 hit in Conservapedia, The Homosexual Agenda. So what you have out there, my friends, this really defines the war, does it not? We are the most despised people on the planet, and they are desperately, desperately trying to justify their prejudice. Homosexuality and hepatitis, promiscuity of homosexuals, gay bowel syndrome, homosexuality and parasites, homosexual couples and domestic violence, any topic they can find to boost their ignorance. Homosexuality and gonorrhea, homosexuality and mental health, homosexual agenda. Well, of course, when I saw the homosexual agenda, I was immediately completely enthralled. I mean, I have been begging for a copy of the homosexual agenda. Somehow, the head homosexuals have misplaced my email address, and I just don't. I seem to have fallen off the homosexual agenda list, but I have it for you now. I can now tell you what the homosexual agenda is, and it's quite simple. It's 6 points. And the homosexual agenda has been taken from Focus on the Family. And these are the 6 points. You're about to hear the homosexual agenda for the first time. 1, talk about gays and gayness as loudly and as often as possible. The chat room is telling me that there really should be a category of homosexuality in prickly heat. Love it. Thank you. The second point of the homosexual agenda is portray gays as victims, not as aggressive challengers. Challengers. Okay, number 3, give homosexual protectors a just cause. 4, make gays look good. 5, make the victimizers look bad. Now, this is interesting. Make the victimizers look bad. You know, there's almost a little core of truth in there. They're actually referring to themselves as the victimizers. it seems to be, well, there's no sense in wandering down that path. We'll all go insane trying to figure out anything written by Focus on the Family. And, of course, number 6, get funds from corporate America. Interesting. I thought that we were all rich and had all the funds and didn't need corporate America, but I'm sure this has to do with the corporate, like Ford donating to the homosexual agenda, and Microsoft. You recall our story that we did about, what was his name, Henderson, a few weeks ago, who challenging Microsoft. By the way, I have another article buried in here somewhere about that guy. He was one of the people who went to Latvia and spoke at the huge anti-gay rally over there, saying that he represented the United States of America and that he represented the White House. So anyway, I just needed you to know the Conservapedia statistics. It changes every day. I doubt the topics change every day. I seriously doubt it. I'm looking at 2 days worth of, and every single line item is, just go to conservapedia.com. I think it's .com. Maybe it's .org. Who knows? And in the left-hand column, you'll see the word statistics, and you just click on it, and it will take you directly to the most viewed pages. That's correct. The most viewed pages by the 15,000 registered users. Of course, anyone can look, so I guess registered users can change or edit. So this is what they're interested in. They are desperately interested in homosexuality and anything they can use to beat us up with. And, of course, these articles, I haven't the heart to read them. It's a time of celebration. I really just can't be bothered with reading them. You can just guess that it's based on maybe the Dutch study or any number of gussied up reports from the medical industry. So I just wanted you to know they're not looking up Holy Spirit. They're not looking up evolution. They're not looking up brotherly love. They're not looking up communion. They're not looking up mass healings. They're not even looking up Jesus or God. They're looking up homosexuality all the way down the line, with the exception of the number one page, which is, of course, the main page. And Bob is pointing out in production that they're not looking up family values either. I completely agree. Anyway, thank you for that story, Gene. That was an amazing story. And thank you, Bob, for reminding me that of that in production this evening. I just want you to know it's their own statistic. You know, if I were the Conservapedia, I would fudge that. I would go in there and manually edit that out so it at least would have the pretension of people that have something else in their mind than, you know, the holy penis. You know, I guess they call those three things down there the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost. Maybe so, because it's the holy penis. Oh, Lord, have mercy. And Obama did something today that was, he might have done it yesterday, I don't have the date on it, but he spoke words in the 700 Club, which have probably never been heard before. Of course, he did it in the tone of not an outraged gay man or an outraged lesbian. He did it in the tone of a politician trying to, cross bridges. In any case, though, he was at the 700 Club on November the 9th, and there was a video exchange. They asked him about the... sorry, getting the echo. It'll go away in a second, and I can listen. They asked him about the special rights. Here we go, special rights for LGBT folks. Of course, this is the way they always frame it. They had probably just come back from reading an article on Conservapedia. In any case, Obama was asked about special rights and how he felt about special rights for LGBT folks, and this is how he answered it.
On the issue of gay marriage, my belief is that as a public official, my role is to make sure that everybody is treated fairly and everybody has equal rights. I know that sometimes in this debate, there's talk about, we don't mind giving gay and lesbians equal rights, but not special rights. The fact is that right now many gay couples, for example, can't visit each other in the hospital. And when I, sit down and read scripture, and I think, how would Jesus feel about somebody not being able to visit somebody they love when they're sick? I conclude that that is something that is important. And certainly as a public official, it's important for me to make sure that those basic rights, that basic equality is available. On these issues, I think we can disagree respectfully, disagree without being disagreeable, but we have to remind ourselves of all the things we agree on, which is that children should be cared for, that we should be promoting the safety and security of the United States, that we want to give economic opportunity to all people. My hope is, I understand there are going to be some people who can't vote for me because of a couple of these positions. I just want them to know that these are issues that I don't take lightly, and I respect their position.
I don't think words like that have ever been spoken in the 700 Club. I think there are still little old ladies looking on the floor for where their teeth fell out, and the little old men, too. I'm sure there are people who are clutching their cardiac resuscitators and grabbing their oxygen tanks. Never before has it been pointed out on the 700 Club that we have any difficulty whatsoever in making any medical decisions or even visiting loved ones in the hospital. And, he did an excellent job with that. He was, a politician. He went on to say, I understand that and that you might not be able to vote for me. Of course, I would have been much harsher, but then I'm not running for anything. What can I tell you? So Obama done good. Now, I can just see Hillary up there. Now, Hillary would have, by the time Hillary finished speaking, I have got to tell you, nobody, not the Christians, not the liberals, not the Conservapedia people, not anybody on this network, nobody would have any idea what she said, because she's that good. She is that studied. She is articulate and is able to slice and splice audio on the fly. The woman can start out appearing to say one thing and end up with something else. Of course, she's going to be the next president, in my estimation. It seems that it's the inevitable march to her being the candidate. And I don't think there's anyone in the country that feels that any Republican has any chance whatsoever. I don't know exactly what we're going to do with that. Someone in the chat room pointed out the other evening that perhaps we've had enough of two dynasties. Two Clinton, we look like we're going on two Clinton presidencies, Bill back-to-back, and two Bush presidencies, and now we're talking about a third Clinton presidency and perhaps a Jeb Bush presidency in 2012. You know, the gene pool, you know, we really need to do something about our gene pool. We really do. Maybe something about training honest politicians, I don't know. And okay, all you lesbians, hang on to your hats. There are going to be some lesbians gnawing through the straps over this one. They're going to be gnawing through the straps and taking to the streets. This is just going to kill you. Texas University. He is a junior at Texas University, and his name is Ryan Hackner. And that's the University of Texas at Austin. He wrote a commentary for the Daily Texan, which is a little rag they have going there. And he's not pleased that you're not wearing dresses, women. He is not at all pleased that you're wearing... I mean, is it unbelievable that this is coming up in the 21st century? This man... Okay. He says, what's not sexy is feminism, not to be confused, rather, with femininity. He says, it's directly responsible for the disappearance of our beloved dresses and the adoption of pants by, quote, new women. He says, like all fashions, pants are symbolic of something, in this case, masculinity, through their allowance of physical activity, meaning you got to keep your legs together and, you don't have as much range of movement, perhaps, he's tried to say it in a dress, unless, of course, maybe it's floor length. But pants give you greater agility. I mean, you wouldn't want to play football or hockey in a dress. It would probably restrict you a little bit. But that's not a good thing for women to be allowed any physical range of motion. He says dresses are the antithesis of pants. He says that dresses symbolize femininity through grace and elegance. Men find elegance in women to be attractive. Listen up, you lesbians. And dresses are a physical manifestation of femininity. The wearing of pants by women represents the masculinization of the fair sex, which is not at all attractive. Yes, you women, you need to be living up to the male expectation. You really do. God put you on this planet to make men happy, and it makes them happiest when you are a sexual object. Listen up, you lesbians. I'm going to change your life this evening. He says, in advocating the wearing of dresses, I must distinguish between the flowing, elegant dresses of tradition and the more degenerate and immodest dresses of our present culture. The miniskirt, a dress of sorts that doesn't extend below the knee, is both lacking in modesty and elegance. Elegance is essential to femininity, and the lack thereof implies a sort of masculinization. Modesty is essential to feminine virtue, and the lack thereof implies a state of 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 horrification. Yes, the lack thereof. You're a whore, my friends, or a lesbian. Immodest, inelegant dresses constitute a degeneration and androgenization of the true dress. Now, I just finished watching a series called House of Elliot. It's old. It's British. It's about a designer. So I have like fashions and clothes on my mind because that was like the whole thing. These two sisters who fought their way up in the fashion industry. Now I think what this man is desperately trying to do, what he's really saying here, is he really wants a job in the fashion district. I think this gay man is screaming to find himself a job in the fashion district, perhaps in New York, because he has a lot to say on inelegant dresses. And he has a lot to say about What was the other phrase he used? Elegant dresses. Elegant and inelegant. And it goes on. Androgynous masculization of the modern woman through donning pants and suits and uncovered shoulders and unveiled hair. Are you believing this? Has in a sense led to the slow, and here's that word again, horrification of... Now, I know you lesbians are going to love this. You're going to chew through your straps. I just know it. It's led to the slow horrification of ladyhood. Now, this is totally new to me, the word ladyhood. I've heard of womanhood. I've heard of childhood. Ladyhood is totally new, and it sounds so fashion district. I'm being asked in chat what the school is again. It's the University of Texas at Austin, and the man is... He's a junior, and his name is Ryan Hackner, H-A-E-C-K-N-E-R, and he wrote it for the Daily Texan. He says, in discarding feminine dress, women seem to have symbolically discarded femininity and modesty. He's got a lot of problems with women. He really does. I wouldn't even want him as a hairdresser. If I were a woman, I wouldn't want him burning my hair. He says, the virtues of women, it says they've traded it all in favor of sexual virility and promiscuity and immodesty, which are all masculine. The ideal form, and here we have it from an expert, the ideal form, now you're going to get this as, you know, advice from a top-of-the-line kind of university guy. The ideal for a true lady is constant, immutable aspects of humanity. And he says, this strange new development of masculinization can only represent a bizarre aberration and a perverse, ignoble culture. He also makes a statement, dresses are essential to any lady's attire and should be worn. So there you have it. How old do you have to be a junior to these days? I thought, what is that? Isn't that like about 19, 20? I see sophomore, junior's probably 19 or 20, yeah. So this man has remembered everything he was taught in the Fundy Church and by his mother that wears a bun and by his father that pretends to sleep with mommy and goes out and hires meth and man ass. Some of my new listeners have no idea what I'm talking about. Believe me, there's a lot of history on this show. Yes, there was a minister. He was in Colorado. He bought meth and slept with a male prostitute for about 2 years. And... it was fabulous. He had fallen in love with him. It was pretty obvious. The dirt. But there you have it, from Junior Ryan Hackner in the University of Texas. And he's distinguishing most definitely between the flowing, elegant dresses and degenerate immodesty. See, the lines like flowing, elegant. This man is a fashion district. He is destined for the fashion district. Oh, my stars. And just when you thought it couldn't get any worse, you ever heard of Nature Boy? Sometimes Blender Nate. Anyway, Huckabee is getting ready to go on the road with wrestler Ric Flair. Now, if you've ever witnessed wrestling, surely everyone has, thumbing through the channels, you really can't avoid it. It's the men in tight pants. It's really very masculine for the men to sit and watch those hard muscles straining against the other and the chests together and the sweat pouring and those bulges and those tight pants. Yeah, baby. Oh, yeah, baby. So anyway, Huckabee is getting ready to rumble. You know, the IQ, can you just feel the IQ being sucked out of the room? He's going to be traveling with him, Ric Flair, a.k.a. the Nature Boy. And you see, Ric Flair has decided to endorse the Alabama governor in his bid for the White House. And CNN has telling us that the WWE wrestler is on board with the candidate, Huckabee. And he is going to co-host a campaign tailgate with the candidate, meaning Huckabee. This is Nature Boy, Ric Flair, and Huckabee. They will be together at the South Carolina versus Clemson football game on Saturday afternoon in Columbia, South Carolina, and I know you're waiting to find out more, but I don't have any more because the details are forthcoming. So, you know, if you're lucky enough to make it to the South Carolina and Clemson, I mean, maybe Ric Flair will be wearing those tight shorts. The shirt will be open, and you can see those rippling muscles and his white hair, just dyed white, looking all studly like a god. I'm sorry, I've just gone a little bit evil tonight. You know, what can I tell you? Some days I'm more evil than others. Okay, it's 10:42. I think we ought to do a little bit of a break, and we come back and tell you some more stories. We have a new PSA, by the way. Bob is going to run it during this break. Let me tell you a little bit about it. It's from GLAAD, and it's the new PSA from GLAAD. It's the Transgender Day of Remembrance. It is a day to memorialize those killed of anti-transgender violence and prejudice. And the GLAAD is, of course, the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation. And they've released this new PSA encouraging viewers to treat each other with respect. I'm sure that if you lesbians would just wear dresses, you'd get all the respect that you like. And that's the problem. So as we go to break, my name is Peter Godbold. This is Strictly Confidential. You're listening to the Head On Radio Network.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at CityNet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance, and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit CityNet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
Round up the usual suspects.
Hi, boys and girls. This is Rick Goodner, part of the Weekend Wrecking Crew. And I'm here to tell you that you cannot miss Billy Shears. The man knows his music. The man knows what you're thinking. Tune in and listen. You'll be surprised. He's going to play the very song that you were thinking that you needed to hear. Now, he's a genius. Maybe a bit psychic. I promise you. Tune in on the weekend, listen to Billy Shears Night Sounds, and you will hear the song you've been waiting to hear. And you'll enjoy your time as much as I do. Right here, on the Horn, Head On Radio Network. Make sure you don't miss what you've been waiting to hear with Billy Shears.
I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
As time goes by.
Gay and transgender people are part of every community.
We are your neighbors, your co-workers, your family.
If someone you know comes out, be willing to listen.
You have the power to make a difference by treating others with dignity and respect.
Choose to be an ally and a friend.
Find out how. Go to glaad.org. That's GLAAD.org.
And we're back, and it's 10:47. I love that song. That was such a huge hit. Feels like I'm in love. One time we have to play that full track for you. It's just fabulous. This isn't particularly gay news, but it's horrifying. It happened a couple of days ago. I haven't gotten to it yet. You know, no news actually happens until you hear it on Strictly Confidential. This is my policy. This is my story, and I'm sticking to it. Former President Bush, meaning not W, but HW, parachutes, oh yes, to his library. Now, I'm not sure if Bob mentioned this before. I don't always get to hear all of Bob's show, but it's worth a reminder. At the grand reopening of the Bush Library and Museum, the HW version, President George HW stunned the spectators as he arrived to the ceremony via parachute. Now, it's not the first time the ex-president has made a surprise jump. In 2004, he did it for his 80th birthday, and I jumped from a plane from the Army Golden Knights, and he leapt with a team that day. Anyway, former First Lady Barbara Bush, with her string of huge pearls, no doubt greeted her husband immediately after the jump and welcomed him back to solid ground and her big old sturdy Republican... Never mind. Their children, Neil, and they have a child named Doro, D-O-R-O, didn't know that, and Florida Governor Jeb were all caught off guard, surprise, surprise, by the jump, and they evidently were not in on the plans, according to news from KBTX. I rather doubt that. You know, Bush, H.W. jumped during his time in the Navy World War. He was in the World War II, and his plane went down in the Pacific, and he was forced to bail out parachute and blah, 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 blah. And where was your son in the WOA? Daddy, where was I in the WOA? Bob is saying no, he didn't do the story. He just couldn't. I have no pride. I'll tell you anything. I love dirt. I'm the Rhoda Barrett of gay radio. And a gay Italian choir boy was dismissed. By the way, it's an interesting story. He is an Italian, and he's been in the choir and been forced to leave the church choir after publicly admitting that he was gay. He's going to bring the case before the bishop. The story has, of course, has the gay rights group in Italy in an uproar.